Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Volusia County School Board. This is a Volusia County School Board workshop on a Wednesday, which we don't often do. And I'd like for everyone to please stand for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, liberty and justice for all.
Once again, I want to thank everyone for being here for this workshop and also for those listening via the internet. I will mention that all school board members are present with the exception of Ms. Ida Wright, who had a conflict this afternoon, needs to meet with Bethune-Cookman University president, so I guess that's a very important thing to do as well. However, Ms. Wright has informed us that she will be here for our school board meeting, which will take place later today, starting at 5:30. So we have three items on our agenda this afternoon, and we begin with item 2.01, our superintendent's search. And Kelly, are you going to start this off? Or Bill?
I think we're doing the timeline first. So I think
we're going to start out with the school board naming the committee members.
Starting with the school board naming the committee members. Okay, mm-hmm. That sounds great. Then school board members, if you'll indulge me, I will start with the organizations that we collectively identified as being the groups. So for these, would you want the name and the organization that they represent?
Yes, please.
Okay. So the first organization is Volusia United Educators. And the representative for that group will be Elizabeth Albert. The next organization is Futures Incorporated, and the person representing that organization will be Jeffrey Brock, B-R-O-K. Jeffrey Brock, he is the current president. The next organization is the NAACP. National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, and the representative will be their president, Cynthia Slater. Cynthia, C-Y-N-T-H-I-A, Slater, S-L-A-T-E-R. The next organization is FAITH. It's an acronym, F-A-I-T-H, FAITH. And their representative is Pedro Dash, D-A-S-H, Pedro Dash. The next organization is the Hotel Motel Association. May need to check that because I think they've changed their name actually now to Lodging and Hospitality Association. But anyway, I think we all know which one I'm talking about because we all know the representative, and that's Bob Davis. Bob Davis. Our next organization is the Volusia Manufacturing Organization, and their representative will be Jane, J-A-Y-N-E, Jane Pfeiffer, F-I-F-E-R, Jane Pfeiffer. The next organization is the Realtors Association. And representing this group will be Bill Navarra, N-A-V-A-R-R-A. Bill Navarra. followed by the Daytona Beach Regional Chamber of Commerce. The representative for the Daytona Beach Regional Chamber of Commerce will be Heather Vargas, V-A-R-G-A-S, Heather Vargas. Our next organization is the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. And the representative will be Inez, I-N-E-S, Nazario, N-A-Z-A-R-I-O, hyphen Vega, V-E-G-A. Inez Nazario Vega, Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. And our last organization, if I'm counting correctly, is the Volusia County Council of PTAs. And the president this year, the representative will be Linda. And the last name is Wither Wax, all one word. It's spelled W-I-T-H-E-R-W-A-X. Wither Wax. Now, did I give you 10?
Yes, sir.
Okay, yeah, 10. All right. Thank you. Thank you. Now, Connie, I do have all those, and I have their phone numbers, email addresses for all of that, so we'll give those to Connie.
I'll be glad to get that from Connie.
Okay, great.
Yes, thank
great.
You.
Mr. Superintendent, I'll pass it down for you to pass it in this way. It's out of my hands right okay. now, as we say. A lot of paper. All right, so now we have 10 people. And because Ms. Wright is not here, she gave that information to Connie. Connie gave that information to Ted. So Ted has the names, so we'll just submit those as if Ted was Ida, and we'll go around. Jamie, do you want to go first, and we'll just go around and.
My first name.
And excuse me, just before we start, all we need is the name. Yes. We don't need the email and the phone numbers for right now.
My first name is retired Colonel James R. Pugh III, and Pugh is P-U-G-H.
Could you repeat it, please?
Retired Colonel James R. Pugh, P-U-G-H, the third. I'll just give you a brief thing. He actually retired out of running our junior ROTC at DeLand High. And so he has been on one of our school campuses for many years, and he lives in the area, and he said he would be honored.
Great. Ms. Cuthbert?
Renee Sanders, R-E-N-E-E Sanders. She's a student, with permission. She is the president of the student council at Spruce Creek High School.
Awesome. Mr. Cologne?
Kim Short. It's short.
Kim Short. And Mr. Doran for Ida Wright.
Vicki Presley, P-R-E-S-L-E-Y, former area superintendent, right? Mm-hmm. Retired.
V-I-C-K-I, I think, isn't it? Or no? How does she spell her first name?
V-I-C-K-I-E.
Knew it was
done. Yeah, that's a good point.
Okay. My first one here is Joyce Cusack. Cusack is spelled C-U-S-A-C-K. Joyce Cusack. Okay. And we'll go back to Ms. Haynes.
My next individual is Mrs. Claire Beth Link, and Claire Beth is one word. And Link, L-I-N-K, and she's a retired Volusia County sales administrator.
I'm sorry, the last name again?
Link, L-I-N-K.
And we'll move over then to Ms. Cuthbert.
William, middle initial E, Hall, former Volusia County superintendent.
William Hall, okay. And Mr. Clone.
Judith Ying, and that's Ying, N-G-Y-I-N-G.
Could you repeat that?
N-G-Y-I-N-G, and she is a Seminole County teacher and is married to a Volusia County Schools teacher.
And Mr. Doran, again, from Ms. Wright.
David Fisher, F-I-S-H-E-R.
Okay. And my second one is Anand Jobalia, and I'll spell it, A-N-A-N-D, Anand, and his last name is spelled J-O-B-A-L-I-A, Anand Jobalia. Anand is he and his father have been in the development business for quite some time, and Anand's a young man, has two children. Ms. Haynes.
So my third individual is Mr. Jan, J-A-N-S, Collins, C-O-L-L-I-N-S, and he's the Associate Dean for Operations in the College of Arts and Sciences at Embry-Riddle University.
Excellent. Ms. Cuthbert.
Angela Kopnicki, K-O-P-N-I-C-K-Y. She's the chairperson of the District Advisory Council.
Mr. Colon.
And Rob Denninger, so it's probably Robert Denninger, D-E-I-N-I-N-G-E-R. And he is president and CEO of Advent Health Fish Memorial.
And Mr. Doran for Ms. Wright.
Sandy Bishop, just like it sounds.
Sandy Bishop.
That's good.
Yeah. Great names, great people. And my last one here is M. Jason Meyer, so it's M. And then Jason is spelled J-A-Y. S-O-N, Myers, M-E-Y-E-R. Jason is the owner, operator of Synergy Billing. And to further, Jason is a former student of mine, and Jason has five children, five boys. Yes. I think the oldest one's in fifth grade. So, yeah, great guy. So there you have it. Everyone has submitted three. Okay. And now, what more do you need from us?
Well, just regard to the membership, I'll just follow up with Connie and make sure I have the contact information, and I'll provide her.
And so, do you need board members to give that information to Connie?
That would be great. Yes, please. And that can happen, you know, in the next day or two, because we have a little time.
And let me ask you this about. I know the first meeting's not till September 26th, and we have two board meetings between now and then, September
yes.
10th and one September 24th, I think it is. In the event that somebody that we just put out there says, you know what, something's come up, I just can't make it to two of those, at any given time, can we replace that person?
Yes, I think up until the very first meeting, if there is, and that has happened before, we've had
sure. I
at
mean,
the last
you know,
minute.
Things happen
yes.
to people, and want to be fair.
Yes,
and,
absolutely.
in the event that we get requests, somebody comes forward and just says, oh, you know, we really should have put Miss Jones on this committee. How did we overlook her? Is it all right to add somebody to the committee? Does anybody have any?
And we could probably have to talk about it later at the next meeting, but to delegate the authority to the chair.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, if we need to. And
any changes or?
Yeah, I'm just trying to anticipate what could happen. Like, anything could.
Perfect.
Yeah, like, oh, don't go there. Yes, Ms. Ames.
I actually thought that when we spoke last time about this and we brought up this, I brought up the student piece.
Yes.
That we talked about allowing, not taking, even though Linda already had a student, not taking one of our other slots because some of us already had our people set, but adding that student that has been emailing us.
Yeah. I did send an email to that student.
But I thought we were going to add, you know, like a, I thought we talked about adding a 26th slot last time.
We did.
Maybe I'm wrong, and adding, you know, a student.
We did. We did talk about adding a 26th slot, and we also talked about if Ms. Cuthbert had preferred to have an adult, I'll just say, instead of that student could have been the 26th student. Again, we haven't shut the door because it's only August 28th, and I will... one idea that I did throw out to our fine consultants and also to the student, Ms. Haynes, that's been emailing you and me, I think, the most, was that in the event that he or other interested students, because we may hear from some other students between now, if they wanted to meet with the consultants as a group of interested students, we could call them a group and have them meet before one of our meetings and spend 1 hour with them and even more. So I don't want to exclude kids or students, but just want to make them.
We could certainly look at that group as an internal focus group, just as we've done other groups.
Awesome.
So that would be fine.
Awesome. Thank you so much. All right, so everybody knows what to do. Just give Connie your contact information about your group. I'm going to give this for those three that I just submitted. And here's some more. Oops, sorry. Here's some more. Thank you.
Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You board members, yeah.
If I could, just one note from the last meeting. I think the board had discussed possibly within the next day or two sending a notice to this group that we've just identified that kind of speaks to, you know, thank you for agreeing to serve and welcome, and additionally some information about Sunshine from the attorney.
You are exactly right. And, Ted, I didn't know whether you wanted to draft something that perhaps you and I could sign.
Yes.
And then we send it out. And then I guess it's... I mean, unless they're listening now, or maybe this will be published in the newspaper tomorrow or online. But this is, I guess, their first time learning who else is on the committee.
Yes.
So from that point on, I guess as quickly as possible, we want to alert them not to talk to each other about things. Right, Ted?
Yeah, we need...
If you want to go ahead and speak on the
We need the emails, and I noticed one of Ida writes... appointments does not have an email, so that'll be something we have to track down. Yeah.
Okay.
So we can't do it without the email. So, yeah, I'll draft something up. You can approve it. It'll be kind of a joint thing. I'll do the legal part.
Yeah.
I'll draft something up for you to look at for a welcome thing.
Yeah.
And then
on behalf of the board, you know.
Yeah,
you know,
the board type thing, and then we'll just have maybe Connie send it out or something. To everybody, because she'll have the emails.
Great, good.
And if possible, if the board doesn't mind, if Connie could just copy me on that email, so I'll know it's out. And that would be great. Thank you. I'll
always copy you.
Thank you.
Yeah, can't copy enough people in this business. I've learned. All right, tell us what we need to do next.
John is going to update us on the timeline and talk a little bit about the
timeline. Okay, thank you.
Well, really, from the last version of the timeline, there's only one addition that I have or one adjustment, and that would be the location for our on-site interview, the 3 days that we're having on-site interviews that Thursday, which would be November the 7th. We did Kelly did identify a place for that community reception on the night of November the 7th from 6 to 8.
Okay. So 5:30 to 7:30.
I'm sorry.
Okay, yeah, I think Futures preferred that time, right?
Yes, yeah. And it's at the Sanborn Activity Center. I looked at it myself, and it's big enough. It's a nice facility, I think. Right. It'll be great with having refreshments and everything there.
Whose idea was that on the board?
Mr. Cologne,
Mr.
I think.
Mr. Cologne, great. It worked out. It worked out great. And, you know, it was available. And,
yes.
And Futures thought it
and
was
they were happy to accommodate, perfect. And Futures is going to be providing refreshments.
Nice.
And
thank you. So I will make that adjustment to the timeline and then provide Kelly with a copy of the revised timeline, which, again, barring any unforeseen changes, it should be now our complete timeline, and we can have that posted to the portal to replace the existing timeline that's on there.
Good. Connie, question?
We won't have that for we need to determine how many finalists we're going to have.
So. Right. Based on our current timeline, I'll be bringing back the interview schedule and some details at the next September meeting, September 10th. Yes. The other item, just as an update, I wanted to let the board know that the following ads have been placed. We kind of got a head start last week with our deadline being Monday, but the vacancy has been advertised and is in place in Ed Week, the Florida Association of School Administrators, National Association of Black Administrators, the Association of Hispanic Administrators, the FSBA site has an ad, CUBE, which is the Council of Urban Boards of Education, which is an affiliation of the National School Boards Association that is advertised with them as well. NAS, which is a National Association of Superintendent Searchers, which we're members of, the States Associations of School Administrators and Superintendents, the States Association of School Boards, and also the Broad Center. So those are the sites that we have the ad posted, which is all out there and going strong as of Monday.
Thank you.
And then Dr. Vogel, just briefly, wants to just review a couple of documents, and I think that will wrap us up with the exception of Kelly.
Kelly. Yes, we sent in the packet our protocol for our community forum. This is just for your information, the process that we will use, and also the community input form that people will be sending in, and we will get all of this information summarized and back to the board from each of the community forums. And we're all set to go for our first forum. We've been working with Kelly on that. One thing that we usually do when we start out, we like to have the board members there. If a board member, I think you've divided those up or more, and just do the welcome to the community, and then we take over from there.
Okay. Is it, do you prefer that the board members stay for the meeting, or
it's totally optional. Some board members like to stay, some just welcome, and then they will leave. But board members are usually not active participants.
Right. Got that. Just wanted to have some guidance on that. Yes.
And Kelly and I have been working together with John, and we're all set on that. And then our final item was Kelly. I was going to update us on the portal, and then the awesome brochure, which she and her team put together.
Oh, great.
All right, yes. You have the brochures in a packet in front of you, 50 copies for each of you to hand out as you would like. On Friday, we went live with our online portal. We have the online survey, the brochure, the community meetings listed there several times, the timeline, and a link for any applicants to apply, which basically takes them to Mr. Reichert's email address to apply. So far, so good as far as feedback on it. want to thank Tom Melton, Joe Sutta, and Frank Fitzgerald for staying late on Thursday, working out some kinks to make it happen. But yeah. We have it right on the front of our website. We have the featured. We have it twice on the front of our website. And then we have it in each section of our website that you click on, the parents, students, community, district area. So it's everywhere on there. We're putting it out on social media as well, and I've been doing updates. I plan on doing it once or twice a week, saying, don't forget, the community forums are here. It's coming up. You can come and have your voice heard on what you'd like to see in a superintendent.
And what was our deadline on the survey, online survey?
September
20th. The
25th.
5th.
So that coincided with the deadline for the applicants to send in their resume. Is that?
I'm sorry. The advertisements close on September 25th,
right,
and our online survey closes with the results going to the board members on September 30th.
Okay.
A few more days.
Okay. A few more days. Great. Just so everyone knows that. If I recall on the survey, it is anonymous, but they do indicate if they are an employee or a parent or
yes.
a community member,
right.
I believe.
And it also asks for a zip code.
And a zip
code. Give an
code.
Idea of what people in different areas are looking for.
Okay. I know I had a question, maybe other board members did, about can an employee serve on the committee, on the citizens advisory committee, and Mr. Doran had advised us no, that an employee of the school district couldn't serve on the citizens advisory committee, and then the question was, well, what about Elizabeth Albert? And Mr. Doran explained that. She's really paid, her salary is paid from a union dues and is not a direct employee of the school district. And Ted, if I've misspoken here, please.
No, that's perfectly accurate.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so just wanted to clear up that in case anyone had questions about that. Again, I think there's just ample opportunity for everyone and anyone that wants to get involved in this process, and we welcome that to please do, either online survey through that part or to come to any one of the forums or come to all four of the forums if you'd like, and then also at the reception at the very end to meet the final four or whatever the final three or five turns out to be. It's never too late, and then folks can also just email us. We've always been receptive to just personal emails too. So I want to make sure that the public is aware, as well of all as all of our employees too, that they can and we hope that they do actively engage in this process. Is there anything, Bill, you need from us going forward?
We're right on schedule right now. Just on behalf of the FSBA team, we really want to thank Kelly for an outstanding job. Thank you for assigning her to this project. I mean,
I think Mr. Egner did, actually. But
thank you,
Mr. Egner. Really, and I think our superintendent had a question, too.
Actually, before. It was answered.
Okay.
I would like to recognize Greg Aiken, though, because he is also part of the Kelly Aiken team. Yeah. Who's managing all this.
I like that.
Absolutely. Yeah. We all understand it takes a team to accomplish great things.
Awesome.
A team in place.
Board members, how about you before they leave? Questions, concerns? Happy? I think the process has been great. I don't know if there's any. I heard Hillsborough's looking for a superintendent. Is that?
Yes, sir. There's a lot of people looking.
A lot of people.
There's a lot of opportunities. But, I'm very optimistic, and our team is. And we've had a number of inquiries from all over the country, and I think you're going to have a very strong field apply. This is a very desirable school district, and as I said the last time, the board dynamics in this district are very impressive for us, the way you all have come together, and and reached agreement on several issues through this process so far, and that's so important.
That's great. And Mr. Klum.
Yeah, the only thing, so we all received dozens of emails from some teachers. Mr. Doran, for the sake of the public, can you explain why we wouldn't want, and I'm sorry, I don't mean to put you on the spot, I usually let you know ahead of time.
Yeah, that's fine.
Why we wouldn't want active employees to be a part of this process? Because we received dozens of emails from folks, and would be the conflict?
Well, the conflict, if it's not obvious, is that the superintendent hires and fires all personnel within the district, either directly or indirectly, or recommends to the board for appointment. So everything flows through the superintendent, so it would not be appropriate to have somebody sitting on a committee that would, in effect, in a very basic way to say it, select their own boss. And so that's why a present employee of the district would not be appropriate to serve on a committee that's going to pick the person who would be, you know, overseeing their employment.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Klum. Ms. Haynes, Ms. Cuthbert, any comments, questions? You happy with the process? Happy with where we are?
I think they've done a great job, and I think there's lots of opportunity for input.
Yeah. Thank you. Ms. Cuthbert? Same.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Before you go, I know you were asking me if they needed to be here for the 5:30 school board meeting.
Right.
I don't really see anything. Would this just come up as a group then? We're going to – these names that we just submitted, Mr. Doran, will we – I mean, just kind of tell me it's a board action item, and will we just say that the a motion to approve the committee as proposed during the workshop today?
Yes.
Is that how we're going to do it?
That
okay, and it'll just be one motion.
One motion.
To
one
approve
vote.
The whole group.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. So then I don't see a need for you all to go ahead.
I just want to make sure that it's said so we don't forget. The point of that, in part, is to take citizen input if there is any.
Right.
Yeah, you know, right. Because citizens need to be able to speak to the issue. I don't
Absolutely.
Know if anybody would, but I mean, if somebody came up and said, oh, well, you know, so-and-so has, you know, a felony conviction or something.
Got it.
And you didn't know that.
Got it. Sure.
So,
sure.
Right.
Fair enough, yeah.
Great. I don't foresee any of that.
Yes.
I'm just saying that that's the reason.
And, Mr. Chair, if anything comes up that you would need us, certainly if Connie could call us real quick, we both will be available. She has our cell numbers. If we could respond to any quick question,
okay.
We'd be glad to.
Okay. I know you all live far away, and I just didn't see any need for you to stay here for another 4 hours without cause. So, okay. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, then. Board members, we'll just continue with our workshop, and our next item is item 3.01, Palm Terrace Support, LSI External Operators. So, Mr. Superintendent, do you want to introduce this one? Thank you.
This presentation will be presented by Rachel Hazel, Interim Chief Academic Officer, Dr. Catherine Dyer, Director for Curriculum, Instruction, and School Improvement, Mr. Tucker Harris, Principal, Palm Terrace Elementary, and Learning Service International staff. And Rachel, I think you're going to lead the discussion initially.
I am. Good afternoon, school board members, Chairman Persis, and Mr. Egner. I have the pleasure of introducing Eric Paul from Learning Sciences International and Shannon Gerby. This is the external operator that we contracted with to support Palm Terrace as a result of the third D. It is legislated and mandated by our State Department that when a third D is earned, you have the option of choosing an external operator, closing the school, or going with a charter school. And we chose the external operator. We think we have found a very good partner in Learning Sciences International, and they are going to go through and explain exactly the services that they provide and how our year has started off with Palm Terrace. So I'll turn it over to Mr. Paul.
All right. Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. I appreciate the opportunity to come speak with you guys today, give kind of an overview of the work that we've been doing with Palm Terrace for the last few months, and then kind of give some action items with some progress we've made and what our next steps are, and then go through this brief presentation and then any direct questions you may have. We have Ms. Kirby here, who's the school leadership coach, working with Mr. Harris, and Mr. Harris is hiding behind me, but he's happy to step up and talk, as you know Tucker is. Sorry. So our kind of journey with you guys in a partnership started back in May when we came in for our school comprehensive needs assessment. And it is a full inspection analysis, a four-day process with 16 members, where we looked at all of the different operations, leadership, instructional, and curriculum at the school. And we do that to try to look at every aspect of the school, from instruction to systems to processes, looking for both strengths and then areas of growth, and then coming up with action plans, what we think our next steps are in terms of moving towards school improvement. Based on the findings of SNA, we really focused ourselves on three goals this year that Shannon and Tucker are working with the team, and that would be to strengthen core instruction, and we're doing that in multiple ways, but we do provide professional development through the teachers, as well as working with school leadership on systems to give feedback and ensure that instruction is improving. Focused student interventions, that was one of the gaps that we identified through looking at the data with Mr. Harris, looking at learning gains for students in different levels, and you know, found that students that came proficient, the majority of them, over 60%, had learning gains, while students that came at a level one, level two, were more in the 20s. So that kind of gives us some indication that they really need a more intense focus on the interventions for students and filling those gaps to get them to proficiency. And then finally, student academic data tracking. There was tracking of data at the school, but we tried to bring a little more intense focus on that, really tracking the lowest 25 and making sure those interventions are lining up. The components of our support at Palm Terrace, we have school leadership coaching, we have rigor diagnostics and walks, which are really a comprehensive walk of randomized classrooms to look for the components of rigor within the classrooms. And we do that four times a year. There's another slide on that in a little bit. We'll get a little more detail. Conditions walks, which I know Ms. Garby and Mr. Harris just completed, I believe, yesterday, where we're taking walking classrooms with the intent of looking at conditions for learning and looking at ways to strengthen those. Professional learning through professional development with our on-site faculty coach. Looking at systems within collaborative planning, making sure PLCs are working and functioning properly and strengthening those where needed. Action planning around what the next steps are through use of the action board and daily stand-up and schedule leadership meetings and support. And then district connection and support with our executive action team meetings and coordination of resources. And we've had quite a big, I think, some real strong movement in that just over the last couple of weeks. We had our first executive action team with Ms. Hazel and Ms. Dyer, and that connected us with some district support in terms of resource teachers and behavior systems, behavior coaches and whatnot. So I know Ms. Gerby and Mr. Tucker has a meeting this week with the district support to really coordinate our services so that we're all on the same page and we're not stepping on each other's toes, but that we're working in synergy to really bring the biggest impact we can. We look at quarterly data cycles. We talked about the rigor diagnostic. It starts with our professional learning. So we had a professional development day in preschool. We have another one coming up September 16th on the professional development day. Following those, our data cycle, we will do the professional development, and then we'll push that support and training through the next professional learning community, where we'll strengthen what they learn in the professional development and really look for implementation. And then the final piece of that is what we call through our growth tracker, where we're doing walks in the classroom, looking specifically for implementation of what the training was. So a lot of the research will say the biggest downfall of training is it's you get it and then you put the book on the shelf and it's not implemented. So we really try to look real hard to or structure ourselves so that we're getting the training, we're following up immediately the next week through PLCs and strengthening that, and then we follow up the very next week doing classroom walks and looking for implementation so we can coach around that. Conditions walk, which we spoke about, that will happen every other week. On the off weeks of conditions walk, they'll do a rigor walk, which is a piece of the rigor diagnostic, but it's really just the classroom components. All these walks are done with members of administration or the coaching staff. Ms. Gerby will usually go on those with Mr. Harris, and they're going to start to blend in the assistant principals and the coaches in those as well. But it's a great opportunity to calibrate walk classrooms share what they saw, calibrate what they saw, so that they're really getting an aligned sense of what they're looking for in the classroom in terms of rigor of instruction. Rigor diagnostic, which I mentioned, is once per quarter, and we'll present that data out on the rigor diagnostic. We do come out with data that we'll present to the executive action team, which will include the different pillars of rigor that we look for, and so we're looking for steady growth in that throughout the four different rigor diagnostic. Our school leadership coaching calls for a minimum of 10 days of on-site support, so Ms. Kirby is on-site at Palm Terrace with Mr. Harris and his team at least 10 days per month. And then our faculty coach, who works primarily with coaches and teachers, but is also involved with the leadership team component. She is on site every day, Monday through Thursday, and then Friday is her planning and virtual day, so she's still connected to the school, but is a virtual planning. So she's basically there full-time working with the staff. The types of support that she provides are really in the four categories: developing coaching capacity, working with the coaches, developing instructional capacity, working with the teachers. The collaborative capacity is what we call through PLCs and through collaborative planning, making sure those structures are intact and strengthened. And then maturing collaborative capacity, and that would simply mean once you get PLCs to a point that teachers are embracing them and we understand the structures and so on, really starting to get that release to the teacher leaders to be able to take ownership of those. Because our goal in any school that we go into, our goal is to work with them, build capacity of leadership, coaches, and teachers, so that hopefully we get out of differentiated accountability, we hand it back over to the district, and the structures and systems are in place to be self-sustaining and move forward. In terms of the leadership coaching, again, we mentioned Ms. Gerby's on-site with Mr. Harris. Includes distributive leadership practices, which they've had a training on that as well, which is basically working with the leadership team on how do you delegate with follow-up, how do you build teacher leaders, how do you build teacher capacity to make some of these decisions so that everything doesn't always come back to the principal or to the assistant principal for a decision. Developing and implementing replicable systems, we talked a lot about that. It's been a lot of work, and Mr. Harris has been fantastic. He's embraced the work entirely, and we're thrilled about that. And just building a lot of systems and structures that can be replicable, so that we always know when, if something comes up, it's not who happens to be the first person you see to put out a fire. There's systems and structures in place to handle these things when they come up. Deepening in understanding of high-quality instruction, intervention, and data tracking. Again, we mentioned those already. Coaching of the administrative team. Ms. Gerby's primary responsibility, honestly, is to work with Mr. Harris to build those systems. But subsequently, it's bringing in the leadership team to understand and also be a part of that. She's done a real nice job with stressing that every decision is a collaborative decision. And although per contract we've got the authority to make the final call, the schools that we've worked in the past, we know it doesn't work that way, and we have to have buy-in, and we again have to build capacity to be able to turn this back over to the school district. So that's a big piece, is expanding that coaching out to the extended leadership team, to the coaches, and then having the leadership team get to a place where they understand coaching and they start turning that over to their teacher leaders. Non-evaluative actionable feedback, which again we do through growth trackers, so we do quite a bit of walks with feedback through one of our metric systems that I'll show you in just a moment. But those are completely non-evaluative. They're generally around the technique and the professional development that's been provided to try to strengthen that. But it is a two-way communication, which teachers love. They do a walkthrough and they see this happening. They can provide feedback through their growth tracker. Teachers can see that feedback, respond to it. So it's an efficient system as well. So you're not, walking in classroom and telling Ms. Jones she has to come see you after school. You can provide that on-the-spot feedback and get that two-way system working as well. Setting and maintaining high expectations for staff, and that's something that when you go into any school that's been low-performing for a while, that's one of the things you need to be aware of. And I know Mr. Harris and his team are aware of that, which is making sure that teachers have the high expectations for kids and that administrators have high expectations for teachers. You can oftentimes get caught in the minutia of the day and forget what your real goal is. So there's been a lot of talk around that with Ms. Gerby and the team, and everyone's on the same page with that as well. And then finally, student-focused decision-making with the leadership team. And that's something that we always stress. You know, we're going to make some decisions on site that teachers won't necessarily love because it is inconvenient or their planning period is not the same place it used to be or something else is going on. We try to stress from the time we walk in that every decision is based on what's best for kids. It takes a little while for some people to come around to that, but because we're all human, but that's where we try to lead all of our decisions. The coaching itself, we've talked about this a little bit, coaching around the core systems and processes, the use of the data systems. They're doing a lot of building with bringing in district resources and trying to really coordinate those. We've implemented several things that I'm going to get to in just a moment, but around student data tracking, which is one of our focus areas, building the capacity of teachers through PLCs, and then identifying and coaching those core instructional practices and giving that feedback and kind of see the trend kind of winding through. We'll be using different tracking tools and different metrics that LSI has, which is a standards tracker, which gives the teachers the opportunity to actually do in-the-moment tracking of student mastery of standards throughout the lesson. When they get trained on that and they get to a comfort level on that, they actually can, through an iPad or through their phone, have the standards for that lesson loaded in. And as students are working in teams or in partners, they can go around and look for evidence of mastery of the standard and actually mark those throughout the lesson. So when the lesson ends, an exit ticket is necessary. The teacher has been able to record that throughout the lesson. That helps build those intervention groups and find out what students need more support. Growth tracker, I mentioned, is our way to give feedback to the teachers throughout our instructional walks. And then trend tracker will have those other items that I discussed, the rigor diagnostic, the rigor walk, and the conditions walk. Some of the highlights. We've been there 3 months, or I should say Ms. Gerby's been there for 3 months, and really worked well with Mr. Harris and his team on looking at some real actionable items that we worked on. Redesigned the master schedule. In that we mean we've really took a conscious look at what's the best format for that in terms of where interventions fall, where core instruction falls, where we can align our interventionists and our support to really look at those students that need the most support. It wasn't a big change, but it was a philosophical change to go from we're doing whole group or we're doing small group or we're doing core and small group to really dig in and say this is intervention time and what interventions mean are we're looking at individual student data and making adjustments and giving instructions to fill gaps. So it's taken a couple weeks to get that verbiage together, but I feel like they're on the right track. We did have some teacher vacancies due to VAM, and you guys are aware of those. Several schools were hit when the VAM scores came out. Ours were hit hard because within an external operator school, you can't have one teacher on campus that's not highly qualified, or excuse me, that's not satisfactory or highly satisfactory. So we did lose several teachers in the summer. We're still in the hiring process. We'll have an update in a later slide. But what Ms. Gerby and Mr. Harris have done is build a tracking tool so that multiple members of the leadership team can be involved with calling teachers, getting resumes together, and moving them through the interview process in a shared document that really streamlines that, because that was a difficult piece, because if I'm in charge of calling the teachers, but I'm in a classroom, teachers aren't getting called. So that was something that they identified early. Leadership team meetings have been established. They have leadership team meetings set schedule, set day every week, and that's used to really plan around the action board. Where are we at with our goals and what we said we're going to do this week? Where are we at with that, and how does that tie into our 45-day goal? The admin team meetings as well, which is really a situation that at a school, oftentimes you just run different directions and try to meet with your team when you see them in the hallway, but we know at a school with a lot of moving parts, it doesn't work that well. So Mr. Harris has established a time where he meets with his APs once a week, really to go over the logistics of what's going on, and it's more to make sure that they're on the same page and heading the right direction. PLCs have been not restructured because PLCs were running, but the expectation of those and the leadership of those has shifted a little bit to the coaches. Away from admin right now, so the coaches right now are leading them until they get the structures together, then we can start releasing those to teacher leaders. We've established student behavior team meetings where we had several people have had their hands in student behavior tracking, whether it's the social worker, whether it's the school psychologist, whether it's the APs. We've established an after-school time once a week where all of those people come together so they can really track kids and make sure we're aligning resources and making sure that we're tracking them through the MTSS system so that we're not working in isolation. Student behavior tracking tool. It's just another tool that we brought over at a from schools we worked with in the past, we're just getting ready to get that off the ground. But if students have classroom or calls from the classroom or referrals, it's a shared document again that we can track what student is being taken out of class for what reason, what's the teacher, what's the time, so you can really get with your student behavior team and look for trends. So is Ms. Johnson's class always getting kids that are getting sent out for behavior right after lunch? Then we can start rolling support in there right after lunch to be proactive about it. Or if one teacher is having a lot more referrals than the other, then we know we need to offer additional support and training for that. So it's another efficiency. At a school with a lot of moving pieces, the more ways you can find tools to help us be more efficient and focus our support, the better we're going to be. And then finally, I mentioned briefly the action board and the daily stand-up, and that is during leadership meetings where they look at their goals, weekly goals that lead to their 45-day goals, and then they have a daily stand-up where all members of the leadership team will come together for 5 or 10 minutes in the morning just to check in on progress yesterday, make sure that we're holding each other accountable for doing what we said we're going to do, and is a good way to connect with the team at least once a day before the day gets away from you. Two dates since we actually came in, Ms. Gerby has been on site working with Mr. Harris 30 days at this point. Faculty development, again, through professional learning, these are the different things that have taken place. We've had the Wonders training. We've had our first training on the 8th of August. We've had through ERPL on the 14th, working on what their core and intervention block should be structured like. We've got our plan PD for September 16th, and then PLC planning has been in support of the professional development through all grade levels. Again, we tie that in through the PLCs after we do the PD. And then those classroom walks that I discussed after the training, we call them C4Is, Coaching for Implementation, and those are scheduled with the faculty coach and the school-based coaches to walk classrooms and give teacher feedback after the training. I mentioned many of these leadership development trainings that we've already done, target task alignment, which is the professional development that we provided on the 8th. Before we do any professional development, the leadership coach will meet with the leadership team and preview that. So they get probably a one-hour preview of what the training is going to look like for teachers, in the subsequent days so that the school leaders are always just a little bit ahead so that they can be active participants at the table and make sure that they're, hand-in-hand with their teachers. But we don't want them to hear it for the first time because we like our school leaders to look like they know what's coming, so we always preview those techniques with them. We've also done designing implementation, which is really a way to look at what our support is going to look like and what the goal is, and then action boards, distributed leadership, and the PBIS and conditions components. Some of our celebrations, you see Mr. Harris there, locked in with his teachers in our first professional development. And these are some of the celebrations that we see, right off the bat, that Mr. Harris is enthusiastic about the new structures and the focus on achievement. He's really started to, he's really embraced it. And, I'll let you speak to him if you have specific questions. But I get feedback through Ms. Gerby every week, and then I'm usually on site just doing a site visit for a half day twice a month. And generally, once school gets going, it'll be walking classrooms and then meeting with Ms. Gerby and Mr. Harris just to look at barriers and celebrations and where are we at, and then offer any advice or experience that I may have in different areas. But, if you know anything about Palm Terrace, and we're learning quick on the ground, the teachers look to Mr. Harris to see if it's okay. And I've told him the same thing, so I'm not telling him anything. So we could have the best thing since sliced bread. They're going to look to Tucker and say, is it the best thing since sliced bread? And if Tucker's like, yeah, it is, then they'll enthusiastically run towards it. So he understands that. He understands the dynamic of that. So we're excited that he's really dug in and got involved. The teachers and leadership were highly engaged in professional learning. It was Ms. Gerby commented to me afterwards, it was one of the best trainings that she's been in terms of engagement with staff. So we were excited about that. And then the beginning of the year, even though we had multiple vacancies, the leadership team did a great job with the contingency planning so that all students started with a certified teacher in front of them the first day of school. So we're phasing those out as we get those positions hired, and we're getting closer to that goal. mention some of the coordination with the district. These are some of the meetings that Ms. Gerby's already had with the district, met with the teacher union, and worked with Rachel and Katie also with the creation of the MOU for the Plus One plan. We have had our initial meeting with the school improvement specialist, initial meeting to discuss the district coaching support, initial meeting with the curriculum specialist for resource teacher support. We have meetings scheduled with the district ESC specialist to really look at our ESC program. And, in fact, we have a walk, right, next week? Oh, they did a walk this week.
An ESC data walk
next week. And then the executive action team meeting. So we work real hard to not be on an island, and we have no desire to turn down support. We just want to coordinate support, and that's been our message. Whatever you have, we'll take. Let's just get together and figure out how we can all work it together. Our real next steps is, again, to solidify and strengthen our weekly leadership team meetings. It's a new process, so we're going to get better at it. Continue that strategic and supportive PLCs every week. Again, continue rigor diagnostic will be quarterly. The rigor walks are every other week. On those off weeks, they do the conditions walk. And the coaching for implementation walks are ongoing. So they don't do it just not only after the training do they do it, that will continue every week with the coaches, and they'll start tracking that. So how many teachers, what percentage of our teachers are showing implementation of the technique to this level, and then that'll be a goal on the action board as well, to really get teachers to embrace and start implementing some of the training. And then aligning the intervention support. We've got what I think is a solid interventionist schedule that really would allow an interventionist to be in every fourth and fifth grade classroom during intervention time every day for the full intervention period. Right now it's just a function of staffing. So we have vacancies that aren't filled, so those are gaps in the schedule, but we're certain we're going to get those filled and that schedule will run as planned. And that was a quick overview.
If you have any questions for us, we're happy to answer. We're all here.
Well, I'm sure we'll have a couple. Mr. Colon.
So Mr. Harris, where are you?
I think at this point maybe I should sit down and have Tucker come sit in my seat.
Well, you could. Yeah, you want to trade seats or just add another chair, whatever you'd like to do. That'd be great. And again, for the listening audience, introduce yourself before you start to speak. And
Tucker Harris, principal, Palm Terrace Elementary School.
All right. Thank you. So my question is, what do you need from us? You know, we're glad to have you, and we appreciate you being here. And I don't want to make it sound like we're not happy you're here. We are very happy that you're here. But we got to this point somehow. And there's no doubt that Palm Terrace made great successes last year. Let's throw that out there to begin with. I mean, the work that you did, I saw it myself. I was there at 6:30 in the morning when you started playing Everything's Gonna Be All Right on the intercom. I was there. I saw it. I saw the dynamic. I saw exactly what you described. I mean, that team has done just about everything they could. I know you mentioned vacancies, which we could talk about in a second, but what do you need from us so that we can respectfully do exactly what you all are setting to do, is get us on the right track and get the school the support that they need to be successful from now and forever?
I would say this time, nothing really. They come in at a perfect time. At any standard turnaround, there's three phases. Phase one, you get the conditions right and keep the kids in the classroom so they can learn. And then phase two would be moving to what LSI referenced. Having said that, we did what we needed to do at phase one. LSI is coming in at phase two, and it comes in at a perfect time, merging together what would be a best practice approach to school turnaround. In regard to school vacancy, we're moving quick. You know, we're getting qualified people in there. As I am aware, this is a state issue with vacancies, so it's not necessarily exclusive to Palm Terrace. You know, there's vacancies all over the place in our state now. That's a bigger issue outside of Volusia County Schools. So we're working diligently to fill them. You know, we just have a few left and really intervention positions, so our cores have been covered. So I'm content, just running strong right now and learning as much as I can, with the goal of, as Eric said, to build a sustainable system that can, you know, stand the test of time after they're gone, and maybe even after I'm gone, and Palm Terrace can be a stabilized B school and maybe hit A's every once in a while too. You know, so I think right now I'm good.
Great.
I'll make a request on his behalf if that's okay. Because I just have witnessed this and seen this and been in the school time and time again. The work that these teachers, the clerical, the professionals, Mr. Harris, his administrative team, are doing is hard work. It is, there's never a minute to stop to catch your breath. So I think all of the positive encouragement and the support and the goodwill and when we answer questions that any of us can give would be extremely helpful. I know that a lot of times you all get questions out in the community, and anything we can do to clarify to get the correct information out there would be the best thing.
Great. Mr. Paul?
Yes, sir.
What's our greatest vulnerability right now that would possibly bring you back here this time next year and saying we didn't make it happen that we could do to support our children at Palm Terrace? Other than vacancies, which we know that's
right.
Always a...
I mean, I think, you know, speaking with Shannon and with Tucker, the biggest key right now is getting staff to buy in to some of the new expectations. And they're not necessarily new expectations. I think that I think Tucker would agree, they're more defined expectations. So he's always had high expectations for his teachers, but there weren't necessarily systems behind tracking those. So if with as many moving parts and as many people running, it's to come back to a system to either to track whether it's behavior or track implementation of the technique or whatever the case may be. I think we're getting that. I think just based on the input that I've gotten from Ms. Gerby and the times I've been on site and the talks with Tucker, you know, teachers initially don't know why we're there, or I know we always joke, it was like, nobody wants us here. It's kind of a tough place to go. It's like, we love you, but we'd rather not have you. I get it. We told teachers that. We know that. But we are here, and I truly believe that we're a good partner. But just getting teachers to start to trust, and I think we're right at, and they could speak to it, you know, Tucker and Shannon could probably speak to it better than I could, but I think we're right at that tipping point where we're starting to tip towards they do trust us because they're seeing the things that we're doing are student-centered and the amount of support. We're not just giving them training and saying you better implement it. We're having, you know, people in the classroom. We're supporting it through PLCs. But some people's jobs are going to be a little bit different than they were last year. And so that's something that I know that the leadership team has to coach around and to get them to come around. And Tucker said it before, and we said it probably earlier today. There's invariably going to be some people that are not going to want to do the things that we're asking them to do. And it's not that we're asking them to work beyond their contract or anything else. We're asking them to do some things that they maybe haven't been asked to do before, but they should be doing. And so we'll deal with those when we come to it. But I think right now, from my feel and from, again, my input from Ms. Gerby and Mr. Harris, is that's coming around. We're winning more teachers every day when they see that we're not there swinging a hammer, that we're there running, you know, side by side with them trying to get it done. So I think right now at this point in time, our biggest vulnerability is just making sure we're getting everyone hired and then getting everyone to follow that vision. Tucker had a great, Shannon forwarded me an email that he sent out to staff last week, and it was the action board item was something simple. You know, you're having your standards posted and your learning target and success criteria in every single classroom so kids know what we're working on. And that initially, it was like pulling teeth when they first started walking. And again, now we're walking and monitoring that, where maybe in the past it wasn't as explicit. But within a week, they went from 30, 40% of them to 100% by the end of the week. And Shannon forwarded me his email, and it was a great email because it was celebrating, yeah, this is what we do. But do you remember your last line of your email, Tucker? Something about, no, not boom. We know that was the last word of the email. Something about... this vision is bigger than any one of us or something like that.
Yes.
And that's really kind of the approach that they're taking that I think is really collectively starting to bring people along, that we're all in this. I said this before. I worked with a school, a difficult school over in Pinellas last year, and what I've told everyone is teachers don't this is a tough school. So if you're getting paid the same and your day is that much harder, but you're there for the kids, but you don't feel that support and that love of, if you don't feel like you're part of something more than the four walls of your classroom, we're going to lose you every year. Because I can go to a much school with less conditions, and it's an easier day for me for the same money. I've got to really buy into why I'm here. And the teachers that buy into why you're there are fantastic, and you never want to lose them. So we got to support them, and we've got to love them. So Tucker's good at loving his staff. So I think that's kind of where we are. We're right at that threshold.
Great. And one last question for Rachel. So when we looked at this contract back when, we talked about the possibility of them assisting us with some of our other schools that are vulnerable right now to that triple D, if we want to call it that. Have we found room or a path for where they could help institute some of these systems and sort of serve in that function yet?
Yes. We have our other schools, Champion, Westside, and South Daytona,
okay,
which are other schools that earned a D, have there's different levels of service that LSI offers. This is a big contract with a lot of different services built into it. But there's different levels. They have things for schools of rigor, and they have systems that are designed specifically to do exactly what you said, that preventative approach. And those three schools did designate their UNISIG dollars that they get as a result of the school grade to contract services with LSI as well.
Okay, so they've used what dollars? So they're also contracting with LSI?
It's called their UNISIG grant funds. It's a grant that they get as a result of their grade, their school grade being a D.
Okay.
And they have contracted with them to do not the same services that Palm Terrace is getting, but a little less of a contract for service for those.
Okay.
So I think like it's weekly coaching.
Yeah, and I think that it's probably going to be at your board meeting tonight.
Yeah, I was going to say, because
right, it'll be there tonight, right.
Okay.
Yeah, so, and not to get into that, because we're here for Palm Terrace, but it is a step down where that's the most intensive service. But it is a level of support that we've seen move schools in Osceola County last year, in several other counties that have tried to get ahead of it, where you have versus 10 days a month with leadership coaching, it's generally one day a week, and versus full-time faculty support is one day a week. But it's enough time and enough touches where you can start to build these things.
And those contracts just seem to make more sense. A lot of times the supports that we put in place, use those dollars to put in place, like, for instance, if we were to hire additional personnel, that's not as sustainable because once the grant's over, the funds are gone.
Right.
And so this is a way to get them the support and the professional learning in that amount of time. And the principals were really enthusiastic about it.
Great. Thank you. Well, we're here for you. And, Tucker, please include us in your celebrations. I'd be more than happy to come over there, even though it's way out there. But come over there and celebrate with your team their accomplishments, big or small. So please include us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Colon. Good questions there. Ms. Haynes.
Okay, so I'd like to first start, and I know we're here to talk about Palm Terrace, but since he brought up Westside, South Daytona, and Champion, I actually had a note for later this afternoon about the UNISIG money, so because it listed those schools, but it didn't say what we were doing with the UNISIG money. So is that entire grant that we're being asked to approve later today being spent on those three schools with this company?
I'm going to bring up Katie Dyer, the resident expert on writing those grants, but I don't believe it's the entire grant. Hello.
Hello. Introduce
Katie
yourself
Dyer,
and your title.
Yes. Director of School Improvement and Curriculum. And no, it's not the entire grant, except with Palm Terrace's UNISIG dollars because of the size of the cost of the external operator contract. With the other three schools, they had money left over in their UNISIG dollars to be able to afford other things. It depended on what the individual principal wanted to do at the school site, but they had extra funds left over. In addition, most of them also had TESSA funds. Those are turnaround.
I see that's also funds. Up for this evening. Mm-hmm. I had a question about that, so you're answering questions that we won't have to answer later.
Yeah.
So with this, though, it does not. So I don't see an additional contract unless I missed it with LSI. So are you asking for approval of these funds this afternoon, and then we'll be seeing at a later board meeting an additional contract for LSI for these schools?
So the level of service that they opted for is specified in our previous contract. What we were able to do because of the multiple schools involved and the number of dollars being spent, we were able to get a better price than was in the previous contract. But the services are, it's the extended school of rigor.
Mm-hmm.
So we could bring that back to you if needed, but the previous contract covered it. It's just that the dollar amount is less.
Okay, so I think what I'd like to see, and I'm speaking for myself, not for anyone else, so we have the UNISIG grant up this mm-hmm. evening, which is almost $1.5 million, and then we have TESSA, and I don't have it open at the moment, and then we have the previous contract with them, which I remember what that amount was. I think what I'd like to see is, so what is our current contract with them? We heard today all the wonderful things that they're putting in place with Palm Terrace, and I appreciate Mr. Harris, you know, you and your team and how well you're working with them. But I think I'd like to see, you know, what is the overall cost and where are the funds coming from so that we have some idea of, like, well, what's left that then they're using for additional things. Because it's just not clear when you read any of this.
Mm-hmm.
I read there's 1.5, and I don't know if 1.5 is going to them in addition to what we already approved or whatever. And I love that there's a cost savings involved.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, we can.
Senator, if you don't mind, I'd like some clarity on these grants and what we're actually spending. Because I think we need that in the event that we find ourselves in this place at another time. We then have a clearer understanding of what did it cost us and where did we, you know, pull the money from.
Yeah.
And I have another question. So we've talked about that there's still vacancies, and I know that all of you have been working very hard to fill all of them. Do we know approximately how many vacancies there still are on campus?
Mr. Harris?
As of right now, we have a fourth grade classroom with a teacher who has passed all exams. However, her bachelor's degree has not previously been accepted in the state of Florida due to an international academy. We're waiting for Dusty Sims with the state of Florida. He was contacting his people there to see if there is some sort of waiver or workaround with her due to her effectiveness in the classroom and her relationships with the kids and just her buy-in with the vision and mission there. So, by definition, that's a vacancy. I would argue that, she said, she's passed certification. We're just waiting to see if we can work through this international degree. That was a religious-based school at the time when she graduated. We have three intervention classes, and we are moving to finish up hiring in a second, third grade gifted. So I think that's about it. The request, that's including, like, all in process. So we have, like, a request for hire in process now. So those are, like, what would be considered vacancies outside of, we've got stuff in process now. So that's all we got left.
So I know that you did as everyone else, and you used, like, your intervention teachers and or coaches to fill in. So how many of them are still filling in spots at this time that you're waiting, like, for the processing to be finished or whatever?
Process-wise, we would have a second-grade classroom. That's one of our last intervention teachers waiting, but that hire is in process. Outside of that, that's it.
Okay, and so you, Mr. Paul, mentioned about wanting to have an intervention teacher for all fourth and fifth grade. So how many intervention teachers, if you fill all positions, will you have serving in that capacity this year?
Currently, right now, there's a total of 5 within Title I, and then there's 2 that have been approved through TESA, totaling 7.
And what about academic or any form of coach other than, you know, physical education?
Coaching, basically, we have Ms. Margeson, ELA, predominantly. We have Ms. Diaz, math. We have Ms. Cobb, who came over as a TOA with a heavy background with math. She was a district support, so she's my TOA. So by definition, she'll be moving into coaching responsibilities and maximizing her knowledge there and not confining her and restricting her with managerial duty. So maximizing her. I'd like to think that I know enough to be a little dangerous, and they're going to make me a lot better too. So I'd like to include myself in that. So I would, you know, get five people.
Mr. Clone's already asked, and you've already responded, but if at any time either group says there's something that we need or there's something that we did not think of, I would hope that you would reach out to us and let us know what it is, because those children there are just as important as every child at every other school, and our heart is with them, and we want them to succeed just like you do.
Thank you. And there has not been a doubt that support isn't there. I mean, we are highly encouraged by many stakeholders. You know, Mr. Persis represents us over there, too, as our chair. So that the support has never been an issue, nor will it be. That's why I feel good, you know, and we got big work to do. It's hard work. But as you said, I mean, it's arguably the most important work, because those kids, unfortunately, sometimes start a little behind. And it's our job to catch them up so they can have a chance to finish the race and maybe win.
I do have one final thing. You've already had quite a few trainings. So when are these trainings taking place?
I think Shannon has a talk yet. I hate for Ms. Gerby to come all the way here.
I know. I think she should speak.
I'm a leadership coach, so I'm supposed to be, you know, I call myself the chief of staff, kind of.
If you would just kindly state your name and your title, please.
I'm Shannon Gerby. I'm the school leadership coach for LSI at Palm Terrace.
Thank you.
And the sequence of trainings that LSI provides professional learning, the first one was already implemented during pre-planning. The second one will be implemented on the Teacher Professional Development Day on September 16th. We have half a day, being very careful, of course, with our managed time, on October 14th, where another piece of our next professional learning will take place. And so there is a sequence, and then we'll look ahead to using the ERPLs if we can still bring some other pieces of some additional trainings to the staff, but we don't want to bombard anyone with a whole bunch of stuff, but these are just, you know, there's a core of target task alignment that needed to be done prior to school start, and the learning targets and success criteria is September 16th. And so we are coaching in between every professional learning, and then we're going to look at doing some teaming, but not really introducing a whole lot of new content, just structures for and instructional strategies in October. And we believe as a team that that is plenty to work on and to coach around, but that it will be impactful in every content area. So we're excited about that.
So I'm assuming you have a plan for the teachers that have been added since you already did the first initial training so that they're not left behind.
That is a complicated issue as we continue to add teachers. Luckily, we have very strong support in PLCs. The September 16th date is right around the corner, and we are very cognizant of the fact that many of the teachers, I mean, it will be 5 or 6 teachers that will be at the September 16th professional development. We're not at the August 7th or 8th professional development. So we have been trusting our coaches to bring that into PLCs and to provide additional support for those new teachers as they're brought in. And additionally, there were subs, you know, that were in classrooms too who did not receive any of this training. So they're on the radar as well, but we just don't have the teacher time to take to do a whole group kind of training for six teachers. So we are pushing it into to the areas that they can be more personally supported.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Haynes. Excellent, excellent. Ms. Cuthbert, yes.
Thank you for your presentation and coming here today. I'm very impressed you, and I don't mean to be condescending, but you seem to really know your business. So I'm very impressed with what you've said. Do you mind if I ask a little more realistic day-to-day what you do? Are you on the campus daily? But doesn't matter, whoever would like to.
Well, let me answer that generally, and I have a feeling that Ms. Garvey may be the best one to answer. I'm the practice leader, so I have several districts and multiple schools that I support. So I was pretty involved with Tucker and Shannon during the summer when we were doing a lot of planning since school started, and that's not my role. My role is to support Shannon, to support, you know, Tucker and the team. So I'm on campus personally at least two times a month for half-day visits, and it's more to walk classrooms and to just look for challenges, barriers, and anything that I can help get out of the way or any district support. I'm generally... Ms. Gerby would be considered the district lead, and she's the primary contact with Katie and Rachel. But I'm generally involved with that as well. But Ms. Gerby is on campus minimum of 10 days per month. So I think your next questions are probably going to be hers.
Okay. All right.
I don't know.
Thank
if it gets more into the day-to-day, she's the one.
Okay. Thank you very much. When you come in, do you access our student information system? Do you meet with teachers one-on-one? Do you meet? Do you go to their PLCs? How is the support structured?
Those are all very good questions and relevant this week. I would like access to the student information systems, and there's just a little bit of... I'm not quite sure what the barrier is here, but I'm still waiting on access to that. However, Tucker has been sharing with me the data. We have pulled data from the state spreadsheets, from the Excel spreadsheets, from the district that has sent the FSA data. So we've certainly been working with the data and manipulating that up until the rosters were loaded this year. To address the question of my role on campus. So I am the school leadership coach. So I work primarily with Tucker and the leadership team. I do have a full-time faculty coach that reports to me who is there full-time. I am there about 10 days a month. August was a heavy month with the start of school and pre-planning, and I was delivering my own professional development. So I deliver trainings to leadership teams, to the leadership team, whereas the faculty coach, she delivers the professional learning to the teachers. She is, because again, she's there every day, she works with the coaches, the academic coaches, and through them also works with teachers. She's in the PLCs, and she provides support for her trainings through those collaborative planning opportunities and through PLCs, again, working very closely with the coaches at the school. I've am at PLCs as much as I can be, similar to Mr. Harris's schedule. You know, as the administrator, he wants to be there to support, to listen, to learn, and to drive the work. And just really, if you expect it, inspect it. So if you tell me that you're going to be collaboratively planning around the technique on this day, let me come and listen to what that sounds like. If you tell me you're going to be pulling, you know, all the teams are coming ready with their data in their hands from iReady and ready to do grouping for their classrooms, let's see how that rolls out. So it's a little bit more of a leadership coaching approach, my role. I don't know if that answered all of your questions.
But you have one employee who's on campus every day.
Correct.
There's just one. And extensive looking at data. But as a teacher myself, I also look at attendance and behavior because in discipline, it's very important to make sure what kind of support are you offering teachers to help them with those items? Or is it just strictly data an academic?
Oh, it is not strictly. It's soup to nuts. We actually just had had a leadership team, extended leadership team meeting / professional learning / reflection around school-wide behavior, pulling the data. Of course, I mean, I am very data-driven, so, you know, being very intentional, pulling the data from last year's behavior referrals, comparing it to this year's behavior referrals, looking at exactly where those referrals came from, and then having the team, you know, again, this is a coaching model, so having the team reflect on, you know, the number of referrals that came from, you know, classrooms to the number of that came from hallways, cafeterias, buses, things like that. Driving it down and letting the team reflect on where our needs are, where our gaps are in our school-wide behavior plan, linking to classroom behavior plans. And we are action planning around that. And then we have kind of takeaways, and we're coming back together, you know, the next time I'm on campus to actually implement. So that is not actually part of the treatment plan from LSI, but it is part of the school improvement planning. Through my experiences, I've been a principal. I'm a graduate of the Florida Turnaround Leaders Program. I've worked with multiple organizations from the SREB in Turnaround High Schools in Alabama to working on trainings with other. With another company down in Miami. So I've really been all over the state of Florida and with LSI for the last couple of years working with in multiple counties. So I bring those experiences with me. I am by no means the holder of the secret recipe for school turnaround, but I can bring best practices with me, get advice from people who also have best practices. You know, we collaborate a lot in LSI. So that's part of the overall package that is coming to Palm Terrace. If it's not prescriptive, it is still inclusive of all areas, and I'm sensitive to that.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Ms. Haynes.
So I need to first apologize to Dr. Dyer because there was actually a document laying here underneath of the superintendent.
I'm just going to check.
Search up. Okay. So I see that we went with option number 2 for the other 3 schools. And so you're working with Palm Terrace. Who's working with our other 3 schools?
It's LSI, but I think that Mr. Paul can tell you exactly the names of each of the people assigned.
So we have a person for each.
Well, absolutely. We're ready to go. We're ready for you guys to sign tonight. We're ready to go.
We haven't started yet, though.
We haven't started yet. We're waiting for board approval, obviously. But we've done the groundwork. We actually have where in Palm Terrace with an external operator, we have what's called the SCNA, the School Comprehensive Needs Assessment. With these schools, we have what we call the SNA, which is probably 70% the same components without some of the more detailed pieces. Like in Palm Terrace, we did actual interviews or conversations with every single principal or every single teacher in the building, rather, what's working, what's not, where do you need support, things like that. So those are already scheduled. I've met through Katie and Rachel with all 3 principals, and actually I've also gone out to all 3 schools and met with the principal and their leadership team just to hear about where I know it's 3 new principals, so it was important to hear from their leadership team, what were their struggles last year, what were their challenges, where do they see their next steps. So we've got a good indication about where they're starting and where they anticipate their needs to be. We've scheduled those SNAs, and Ms. Gerby actually is going to be working with Westside. She loves Daytona Beach so much, she asked if she could spend one extra day a week up here. So she knows the challenges of that, and it's been real heavy for her, especially in August with the planning. So, but now that school is going and we're starting to get things together, it's an easy fit for her to be able to flexible with having one additional school. At Champion, it's Dr. Melanie Fox, who's one of our leadership coaches as well, who's a retired principal from Miami-Dade, worked with several of our schools in Palm Beach County last year. And Patricia Perry, Dr. Patricia Perry, will be supporting South Daytona as leadership coach. She was a leadership coach at Mosley Elementary School up in Putnam County last year. That, again, was another school that was in external operator status that moved to a C. So she's had a year of that experience under her belt as well. So we're all excited about getting involved with them. And then their faculty coach will be one day per week, and those have all been assigned as well, and they're all experienced faculty coaches. Over at Westside, we'll have Liz Buzanka. I always pronounce her last name wrong. But she was the faculty coach at Mosley, who came out of turnaround last year. So she's experienced with turnaround work. At South Daytona, we'll have Jen Perez, who was the faculty coach at Lakewood Elementary School over in Pinellas last year, which is in turnaround. So she's familiar with the work. And at Champion, we'll have Sue. I was going to mess her name up too. Schlitzky. Who is
a. Know her.
Yeah, I was going to say she's of Volusia County, and she has worked with Dr. Inge in the past, so we feel like that'll be a good fit. So the team is ready. We're actually anxious to get going, and we know we have to wait for board approval and for actually September 1st when the funds are available, but we've already have a date scheduled to get in for SNA, so we're ready to get on the ground there.
So in this, it does spell out the cost, and so I do see that the cost was reduced for Palm Terrace to $624,000 for the school year from what your original, proposal was to us. I'm a little confused, though, because it says under your option two that it's, which is what we've selected for the other three schools, that it's $250,000 per year, but then in the letter from purchasing, it says it's going to be $225,000 per year. So we got a reduction on those also. Mm-hmm. So what we're looking at is $1.3 million. So I think what I'm asking for is where are the $1.3 million in funds coming from? I'd like to just see, because you're correct, the Unisig, is actually more than what this entire total is. So I think, because it's not very clear, when you look at the documents that we're voting on later this evening, it just lists the schools and it says an amount, but it doesn't say what's happening or how they were divided or things like that. So I'd still like a little bit more clarity, but I do apologize because this was laying here. I wish it had been scanned for us to see prior to it, but I'm good that I have it now. Thank you.
Dr. Dower, you want to respond before Mr. Colon has a question as well?
I can tell you specifically.
If you can pull that mic a little closer to you. Thank you.
I can tell you specifically with South Daytona, Westside, and Champion, all of it comes through Unisig funds. Okay. Those are sufficient. With Palm Terrace, we are using Unisig funds, 321 of Unisig funds. 70,000 of instructional leadership development and faculty grant funds, and I'm going to get the rest wrong if I don't look at my notes. But
that's also on for this evening. That mm-hmm. faculty and leadership.
Yeah, they're. We've been looking for all different sources to pull from because not any one source does it all. SAI funds are in there as well. Lowest 300 funds dedicated, and. There's still some more. Just need to pull it up.
Thank you, Dr. Dower. Mr. Colon had a question.
So I guess I have a question. I'm not sure if the superintendent wants to answer, but there was mention that the principals, based on their budget, determined what services they wanted to have, and that's concerning to me only because I may feel that I don't need the behavioral tracker, but because I feel I don't need the behavioral tracker or don't want to spend the money on that or want to spend it on something else, I may say I don't want this. Mm-hmm. And so my concern is that we wouldn't be standardizing what we're doing across, what's best practice, and that pick and choose, it's going to really, you could probably speak more to it because you probably cringed when they said, well, we don't need that at some point. But my question, how did that work from a district level where we determined, if these are the five services that we want to focus on, and granted there's always room for culture. If there's not a behavior issue, then there's no need for, arguably. How did we determine that? Because the way it made it sound is it was more money driven versus, explain that to me, please.
So actually, What happened was the principals that we have at those three schools, two of them are former turnaround leaders, and they, when we presented the options to them to have the extended school of rigor or the school of rigor, like those are two different levels of service, or to, you know, work the plans on their own, they chose the highest level of service from LSI, and those supports are standardized. So they, I was a little bit surprised, but I was also, I felt good that those principals wanted the highest level of support, because I know if I were in their shoes, I would want that also.
So that's all standard then? Because I caught when someone said earlier.
Yes, so basically the LSIs have their prescriptions, and then leftover funds can be at the discretion of the principal based on need. So, you know, one principal with some extra funds might purchase a behavioral tutor, but outside of, they have their prescriptions that are proven and they work and their systems are set, then leftover funds at the school would be at the discretion of the principal to be used within that capacity based on the need observed by the principal at that school. That decision doesn't impact their prescription. It's just leftover funds to be used accordingly.
Thank you.
Ultimately, though, since you asked me that in the interest of really fully explaining the answer to your question and risking further confusion, the principals were all consulted, and they were asked what they wanted to do. And this was one choice. And I think what Dr. Dyer was saying, she was almost a little surprised. They all said, at the end of the day, yeah, this is what we should do, and decided to pay for it. Your question goes deeper, and it says, could they have said, no, I'll opt out of that and do this other set of things? And the answer is likely yes, because of the degree of independence we give to principals to be the CEOs of their school based on their local conditions. But to take this just a step further and to help explain the philosophy that I've presented to the board and to others, there isn't anything that, and this is no disrespect to you as the inner team that's coming in to help us, there isn't anything that they're doing that isn't known and research-based. There isn't anything that they're doing that we couldn't have been doing ourselves in a systematic way. There isn't any strategy that's a secret strategy that was unknown to anybody before it came to us. And part of what I've addressed with this, with staff and others, is the real benefit of the system that they've put in place is it will be systematic. These are the things that we know will work, therefore you will do them. And they help prioritize even the district mission. These are the things that work. This is where we should put our resources. So part of the district challenge that I've put forward is to learn from this. What can we replicate on our own before someone makes us? And should that become, as I referenced to you before, kind of the iron ring of what we do that's not negotiable versus what's inside that ring that is negotiable? So if what I propose were to be followed, by the end of this process, we will know what we were already doing, what we were doing well, where the holes are, how we could plug those holes, and then hopefully in a collaborative way, make it clear this is what we do next. And I hate that this sounds negative, but I think I've said it before, so I might as well say it again. In some of the schools where we had so many intervention teachers and coaches and other people coming in, I said, you know, they were tripping all over each other, and the meter for achievement didn't move a point. In fact, in some cases, it went backwards. Well, there's something really wrong with that. So let's start. One, was there a qualified teacher in that classroom from day one? If there wasn't, and you had 8 or 10 substitutes who were there for most or all the year, who was the coach coaching? You know, in other words, you destroy the effectiveness of the model. Ergo, my controversial dictate, and dictates are awful, because they're not done collaboratively. To say we need to fill the teacher and the classroom bucket first before we fill the bucket of people who support the teachers, because obviously there's no teachers there to support. You're supporting substitutes. So that's a big change in philosophy, but I think it mirrors the definition of what is a focus on classroom instruction. So I hope that concept will continue on after I'm gone as to what is our top priority. Let's fill that priority first. Once that's filled, we can look at other options to support that base. And then here's the instructional model you will institute with these characteristics. Now, within that, you have to have a tremendous amount of academic freedom for the teacher. And that has to do with how they deliver the instruction, as long as it's within the boundaries of what are what I would call high-yield instructional strategies. There's 8 or 9 that are the universals. And as long as you're doing that, have some flexibility, have some freedom, have fun with it, be a teacher. But we have to have some parameters of how we do things, the way we do things, and starting with an analysis of what the experts have shown us work and how we can integrate that into our system in a systematic, organized fashion to focus everybody on those things. I will tell you right now, I think, in some ways, as I look through the budgets and everything else, it almost looks like we have never found a program we didn't like. And we've never discarded one because it wasn't working, because we didn't follow up with monitoring, et cetera, et cetera. So I think we can clean this up following models that we know work, and we have the data to support it.
Right, and I appreciate it. Like Ms. Haynes said, this is first time I'm seeing this, so you know it was a spin-off of the conversation because, you know, what's option 1, 2, and 3? Well, you know, I don't know yet. I haven't read through this, but we will shortly. So thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Cuthbert.
When you presented at the very beginning, you talked about what your focus was, and your focus was on interventions that were needed, core instruction, academic data tracking. And based on the gains that Palm Terrace made last year, I do believe their faculty were already focused on that. And what you all bring to our table, which we greatly appreciate, is your expertise, because this is your total business. So it's that intensive focus and that partnership for that support, because it's nice to have someone. And the reason why I asked if there's someone on campus, it's nice to know if we are taking a risk for a lot of these improvement strategies that you said we may not have ever done before, it's nice to have that expert right there on campus to say, am I doing this correctly? How can I tweak it? It wasn't received well this time, but if I did this a second time, will it be better? And that's what I'm very appreciative of your services. And yes, we are paying for it, but at the same time, you are delivering what we're paying for. So for myself, I see your vision. I do appreciate your heart in it. I'm glad there's someone on campus, but that is never to take away from all the great things that you and your faculty do. And it's together in what Dr. Dyer and Mrs. Hazel said, it is a partnership. And the key word that impressed me more than anything is when Mrs. Gerby said, we deliver best practices. And those best practices is what will make our students achieve. So thank you very much.
Thank you. So as you can see, we have a very committed board. They're behind you. They're behind Mr. Harris, behind the teachers 100%. I would like to ask Mr. Harris, because you're the one that was put in this difficult position, seems to me, I don't know, when you got into Palm Terrace in March of that 1 year and then really only had a couple of months, and then had last year, I guess, was your first full year there. You've seen a lot of teachers come and go during your time. How many are there any people at Palm Terrace that were there
the first year that you walked in? I mean, you could probably count them on. I mean, when you walked in there on March of what year was that? Two years ago?
Yeah. That's when Miss Albert was still the math coach in there.
Two years ago.
Not quite 2 years. It's interesting. I tell people the windshield's big and the rearview mirror's small for a reason. You know, I look forward and glance back on occasion. You know, there were some people that were non-reappointed that needed to go, you know, at various reasons. You know, we had an influx of new hires. A lot of schools like that, it's hard to keep sustained systems there. Not systems, I mean personnel, because as Eric said, you know, it's hard work, you know, and when you're mission-driven and heart-driven, you sustain. But, you know, sometimes if the head takes over the heart, you know, you can rationally justify going to another location. But I'm a mission-driven person, you know, so, and I surround myself with those people. So we lost a lot early. I think 17, maybe that first summer may have left. I don't remember off the top of my head. And then we hired quite a bit. I think in total hired 24, you know, that first summer, including faculty and staff. And, you know, we lost a lot now with VAM, you know, but I'm proud to say this, you know, we, last year we had a lot of teachers in the TIP program, you know, first year teachers.
Yeah.
Now we have two. You know, so what that says is that it's not just a place for new teachers to, like, get their feet under them. It's a place now where I think the mission is profound. You know, that's why people started teaching, I think, or schools like Palm Terrace, you know, to make a bigger difference, you know, in this world. So that climate and that culture and that camaraderie is bringing in good people. I mean, of course, the money that from the state helped kind of push people over, but that wasn't the main rationale for people bouncing over there. That was maybe a hinge point to tip them over. But you know, it's very dynamic. It's a lot going on. The work is intense, and you know. But I'm the first one to tell somebody if it's not good, and I will speak from my heart and. I'm very happy with where we're at with LSI now. I mean, it's like anybody, it takes a little, you know, it takes you mentally. It's like being, you know, I tell people athletics, you know, I mean, when you lose a championship game, you know, you don't just jump right back up the next day and go run into practice. You know, it takes you a little time to mentally get past it. And when a new coach comes in, you know, it takes a little time to adjust to them too. You know, that's a natural learning curve, but you know, I'm learning, you know, and that's important to me. And, you know, thanks to Katie, because when we started this external operator interview, my rationale was get the cheapest one in there because I don't need them, you know. And that was, I mean, I spoke to that to them. And Katie and Rachel have a way to calm me down and get in my head. And they said to me, you know.
No, I don't believe that part. Maybe
they
get
said,
in your head, but not
They do. They just wait for the right time when they know they can get in there. And then they explained to me, like, you know, the bigger picture and really painted a good picture for me to understand the bigger purpose of it all. Yeah, I can be kind of narrow focused at times. So, and once I got that, it really made me realize about not only the learning of myself, but the learning of the district and how we can get sustainable systems. So, I mean, hindsight, I mean, if they would have listened to me, we wouldn't be as good a place we are now. And I'm glad I listened to them because, you know, I'm in a great place. I mean, the action boards and stuff, I already feel like a more effective principal. I mean, I really do. You know, so it's just really cool because, you know, I want to be the best, because when I'm the best, I get the best out of kids. So they're going to coach me and I'm excited. So, you know, we're just going to cruise along and get to a B. And Mr. Klein, you will be invited to the B barbecue, you know, this summer when we celebrate.
Thank you. How would you describe the morale at the school right now? You have so many new folks and this group coming in. I mean, you know, just talk to me.
Morale is driven. I drive morale, you know, so it, as they said, that's the role of a leader. You know, there's times you lead and there's times you manage, you know, so a leader builds morale and sets climate and culture of a building, you know. So the morale's great. Of course, like they said, and we have, you know, there, you know, when the external operator comes in, there's some, you know, feelings, you know, some misconceptions, some, you know, rumors and, you know, all that stuff that happens, as you know, as a long tenured principal, that just when something starts going, it runs crazy. And, 10 positive things can be overrun by one negative thing, and that's just how schools are. But, I mean, overall, the morale's good. You know, we're getting ahead of any misconceptions, you know, and just making sure that we stay unified and really stay focused on what the intent is, and that's to improve instruction and there make the teachers more successful with the goal of improving student achievement. But I mean, we have a good time there. I mean, there's some times that they were a little kind of unfamiliar with them coming in. And I think Eric referred to them as like the step kid or something like that coming in at times. But then once you build that family environment back, you know, I'm remarried and, you know, my wife has step kids and we call her much mom. So, you know, once we get that relationship rebuilt, you know, it's a great thing, but it takes time, you know, but I stay ahead of it and I'm a culture and climate guy. And if that's not right, then I take full accountability for that.
Good, good. Well, keep the joy in Palm Terrace. It's a great place to be, and I'm sure just the short time you've been there, Shannon, you have seen that, and you will continue to see that as you spend more and more time there.
Yeah, I just want to echo that everything Tucker said is true, and he's driving it, and I've never been at such a welcoming place where I knew I wasn't really wanted, like I said, you know, there's a stepchild, but I felt so welcome, and so it really is a great culture, and I know it's being driven by great leadership.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. It sounds like it's a great partnership, Mr. Superintendent. Any final comments from you?
Well, I'd like to echo thank you to to the principal. Principals like to be the CEOs of their building. They like to think that they know the best, and usually they're right. And I know that Mr. Persis and I, as principals, former principals, were sitting here thinking, we would have said, we don't need you, give me the cheapest, and then get out of my way. And so it is so important that we all learn together and we all grow. And I think one of the most telling points of this, which was left out of the discussion up to this point, is regardless of that attitude and the growing pains and the association issues, last year they asked for you to remain because they saw that in you, and they saw that with Palm Terrace would not be the same without you, Tucker. So they saw that and requested that you be in that chair today. Otherwise, you wouldn't, by terms of the state mandate. So clearly, everyone respects your leadership.
Thank you. Yeah, that's great. All right, thank you. And that concludes this presentation. Board members, let's take a 10-minute break, okay? To reconvene our workshop, and we are now on the final item of today's workshop, which is an interesting topic. We haven't had this topic, I don't believe, before us before, exceptional heat illness and athletic safety. We have many presenters with us, and I'll let them introduce themselves with your titles, of course. I know Mr. Colon wanted to make a statement before we began this presentation. Mr. Colon.
So for the record, I am employed by Advent Health. I wanted to be clear about that for the sake of the public. Everything that we are discussing here is part of a contract that was signed last year in June, which predated my time on the board. As is customary in all workshops, we will not be voting on anything during this workshop, and I will be partaking in the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Colon, and we may begin. Please.
Good afternoon, Chairman Persis, school board members, and Superintendent Egner. My name is Kelly Amy. I'm the manager of strategic partnerships, and I have the pleasure of working directly with our partners at Advent Health, district leaders, school-based administrators, athletic trainers, athletic directors, teachers, you name it in this partnership. It's very wide-reaching. And we are working together to implement the Healthy Futures Partnership, which is a historic $2 million partnership. One of the three pillars of this partnership is specifically dedicated to athlete safety. And today, we come before you to address the critically important and very timely topic of exertional heat illness. In the last 2 weeks, Each of our 10 high schools has received over $800 in equipment and supplies for the prevention and treatment of heat illness emergencies. Our goal collectively, quite simply, is to ensure that we are keeping student athletes safe, and we're here today to talk more about what that will look like here in Volusia.
Thank you. And please.
Good afternoon, Board Chairman Persis, Superintendent Egner. Larry Beal, specialist over athletics. I work directly with Kelly and with Eric and Anna as we move and maneuver forward with this process and what we're doing as we're creating documents and creating trainings and conversations with athletic trainers, athletic directors, and principals. We have met with all of our principals, athletic trainers, and athletic directors during pre-planning to bring them up to speed on everything that we had gone through last year, because honestly, we went through warp speed when we started really implementing and started acting and moving forward. So bringing them up to date and continuing to keep them up to date as we move forward with our cold water immersions and our wet bulb globe thermometer processes.
Thank you, Mr. Beal.
And to introduce myself, my name is Anna Donaldson. I am the Director of Strategic Partnerships for Advent Health.
Anna, just pull that mic a little bit closer to you. There you go.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Sure. I oversee the partnership between the school district and the hospital system.
Great. Thank you for being here. Yes.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you so much for having us. My name is Eric Nason. I'm with Advent Health, and I serve as a sports medicine outreach coordinator and work directly with Anna and the fine folks here at the table as we put together a very beneficial and historical partnership that it's an honor to be a part of. And so I thank you for giving us the time to speak with you on a topic that you may not be completely familiar with, but I hope in today's discussion that we can bring to light a very serious topic, but at the same time come to you with some ways to fight it, to prevent it, and to manage it. So today we're going to talk about exertional heat illness, and we're going to present to you two proposals, two protocols that we feel can help manage what is a very devastating problem, and especially here in Florida. So let me set the stage, if you don't mind, about in June in Hillsborough County. And this is just to kind of bring this to the surface of how important this is. Hillsborough County experienced their second death in 2 years from a young child athlete that was participating when the environmental conditions were unfavorable for participation. This child was participating in a preseason kind of conditioning program over the summer in June. And was experiencing signs and symptoms of exertional heat stroke. The school district had no athletic trainer on site. There was no medical care there. And the coaches were untrained and unaware of what to do. EMS was called. And unfortunately, after transportation to the hospital, the child then died of exertional heat stroke with a core temperature of 103. 2 years before that, Zach Martin, same scenario, experienced the same thing. This is 100% preventable and manageable if done correctly and appropriately. And so we want to bring that to you because we never want to hear those headlines here in Volusia County. We don't want this ever happening to our own kids. I'm a father of a 14-year-old high school athlete. I don't want this to happen. And this goes beyond sports. It goes to band. It goes to ROTC. It goes to our own county employees that are working outside, and we can take this further. But let me just educate you on what exertional heat illness is. Exertional heat illness can consist of dehydration and heat syncope and heat stroke. And today we're going to be focusing on heat stroke. And that is when the core temperature of the body reaches 103 degrees or higher. And what it does is it effectively starts to shut down the organs of the body, particularly the liver and the kidneys. And it affects the central nervous system. It makes the athlete or the child or the individual experiencing this unable to communicate or to function, and so these signs and symptoms become very evident. The reason that this is happening is because the body is producing such exertional heat from the activity that they're doing, and normally your body would dissipate that heat, but it can't because the environment is so saturated from a humidity and a temperature standpoint that the body just is trapped with that heat, causing internal temperature to rise. And so that's our exertional heat stroke, is when the body temperature, the core temperature, rises above 104 degrees. But this one statement, if anything, that you can kind of take home from this is that exertional heat stroke is one, if not the only, catastrophic injury that can be 100% survivable with prompt recognition and immediate care. So this is a catastrophic injury. This can result in a fatality, unfortunately, but it can be 100% survivable if it's promptly recognized, rapidly assessed, and rapidly treated. In a recent research done over a five-year period, exertional heat stroke was actually one of the top five causes for deaths in football within high school and colleges. Cardiac, we've heard this come about, and we'll have further conversations about this also. Brevard County is discussing it. Osceola County has mandated it, and Orange County is discussing cardiac screenings to prevent and rule out and to screen cardiac problems with athletes that goes above and beyond what our pre-participation physicals mandate. Head injuries. One of our first things as a partner with Advent Health and Volusia County Schools was to initiate IMPACT, baseline concussion program, to help manage concussions and not diagnosing them, but returning them back to play appropriately. And those child that are sent back prematurely without management are why they're on the second leading cause of death in football. And the third is heat illness, which can be prevented and can be 100% treatable if the right products, the right equipment, and the right training is available. And that's why we're here today, because this is a low-hanging fruit that we as a district and as a healthcare system can help save lives and create an atmosphere of health and safety for our student athletes. So what are the causes of death with exertional heat stroke? The main thing is misdiagnosis. It's misdiagnosis. The data is not there. Anytime you go to the doctor and you are provided physicians that provide diagnostic screenings, the reason they're doing this is to provide proper data so that the doctors can make an informed consent about what's going on and then treat accordingly. Well, what's the problem is our athletic trainers and our medical staff within our high schools may not have that accessibility to obtain that proper data. Or maybe there's a care and a delay in treatment. A lot of times, our first line of defense in our high schools is an athletic trainer on the sidelines, a healthcare professional that is licensed by the Department of Health and board certified nationally should be on the sidelines anytime an athlete or a competition or practice is being held. And that professional will be able to initiate immediate care. It's when those individuals are not around and coaches or other staff are not aware and there's a delay of treatment. Inefficient cooling modalities. The only way to fight exertional heat stroke is to rapidly cool the body. And we're going to talk about that in one of our protocols. Immediate transport. Unfortunately, this happens too often, where a athlete is experiencing exertional heat stroke and is transported to the hospital too soon. And I know that may sound odd, but let me paint a picture. About 2 weeks ago, at a football invitational clinic, a lot of our Volusia County schools were in Flagler Palm Coast for a football game. It was a Saturday afternoon. The heat index was 102 to 104 in the middle of the day, okay? These individuals were doing everything, and I'm going to be speaking about Spruce Creek High School with one of our physicians, Dr. Bill Browning from Advent Health, who's the team physician, and one of their athletic trainers. We're on the sideline doing everything they could, from cold towels to water, making sure that the environment and that these athletes had everything they need. Near the end of the game, a child collapsed. And when Dr. Browning and their athletic trainer assessed this child, they determined rapidly in assessing them that they are experiencing exertional heat stroke.
EMS was called and wanted to immediately start an IV line and transport, which is their protocol. But what they were treating for is dehydration, and what the body needed was rapid cooling. And so Dr. Browning said, I'll take responsibility. This child is going to be cooled first, and then we're going to transport. And so they found a golf cart in a school district that had no ice tubs and no preparation for exertional heat illness. They went and found a training room, athletic training room. They found ice, and they were able to submerge the athlete for about 15 minutes before transporting. And the best part of the story is that he went to the hospital, was released, and had dinner with his family that night. That situation could have turned south extremely fast. So through these protocols, if anything, we are creating an atmosphere that our athletic trainers, our team physicians, and our schools have everything that they need in order to prevent this and then treat it if needed. So as I've said over and over again, some key components is prevention. Prevention with an athletic trainer on the sideline at all games and practices. Prevention through what we're going to talk about is a wet globe temperature monitoring, which is an environmental awareness. And then rapid recognition about what's going on, rapid assessment, rapidly cooling the child, and then advancing them to emergency care. And then monitoring a release by their own physician before returning to play. If these guidelines are followed, we will prevent making the headlines for any exertional heat stroke deaths in Volusia County. So the two protocols from a high level, and I know a lot of you have had a chance to review these, and I was able to speak to the cabinet and present these, but I want to go over them so you understand them and can ask questions. First is the environmental monitoring protocol, which is the wet bulb globe temperature monitoring. Okay, that is going to be our preventative protocol. This is a proposal to create an environment that is going to be focused around prevention of exertional heat stroke. And then a mandatory cold water immersion protocol, which is how we as a school district or our athletic trainers on the sidelines are going to be treating individuals who are experiencing exertional heat stroke. So environmental monitoring protocol, let me put this into a little bit of perspective before I go through the details. Our school district and each school has a lightning policy. And this lightning policy is geared, and even at the Daytona International Speedway and professional sports and our colleges, they all have lightning policies because it's an environmental condition that is proven that it could cause injury and death. And I think we would all agree that. The likelihood of you being struck by lightning compared to experiencing exertional heat stroke, and if I had that data, I'd throw it at you, but I would imagine you're probably 100 times more likely to experience exertional heat stroke than struck by lightning. Although we have a policy for lightning, but we don't have a policy for exertional heat stroke. Why? Because we don't understand it. And we always hear, we live in Florida, it's hot, there's humidity. Well, you know, come on, push a little harder, take a water break, let's get back to play. And we have to change that mentality. And I think through education and planning, we can do that. So this monitoring, this is a picture of a wet bulb globe thermometer. The thermometer takes into consideration ambient air temperature, humidity, sunlight, direction of the sunlight, and wind speed, and comes up with a temperature in Fahrenheit or Celsius that we then take that temperature and we'll plug it into a chart that I will show you here in just a moment that will give guidelines and restrictions and modifications to games and practices based on that temperature. And this is a very simple method that each school can monitor that temperature before practices start, monitor it every 30 minutes afterwards, and give coaches updates on how they need to modify or how they need to change practices or games. So research was done over 5 years. They took wet bulb globe temperatures throughout the United States and created this graph. And this is just to show you that we're in Category 3. They're all modified based on the regions, based on typical temperatures. So this chart here, hopefully you guys can see this. You can see green, yellow, gold, red, and black, and they all have temperatures there. So when we get that temperature, let's say we get a temperature of 85.5 degrees Fahrenheit, wet bulb globe, we would go down and we would see it would fall into the yellow category. And that category for Category 3 says it uses discretion for intense or prolonged exercise, provide at least 3 separate rest breaks each hour with a minimum duration of 4 minutes each. That's one example. If the temperature fell in the red where it was 90.1 or higher, they would have a maximum practice of 1 hour. So instantly it would tell a coach that the temperature's too dangerous. If you go out now, you got 1 hour to practice. And if you're football, there's no protective equipment. So no helmets, no conditioning, no pads. And then for all sports, there must be 20 minutes of rest breaks distributed throughout that hour of practice. So it would take the coach to kind of manage how they're going to run practice and be able to provide that rest in the area for recovery during that hour. And then simply, if it comes into the black zone of 92.1 or higher, there needs to be a cancellation or a delay of any participation until that temperature decreases. That is the wet bulb temperature monitoring or the environmental protocol. It's simple. Currently, every high school has this device in their hands. Part of Advent Health's partnership, we have purchased these devices and have given them to every school. And they've been trained on how to use them, and we are providing documentation for them to document each day, the date, the time, the temperature, and then the response. And the notification of coaches. And we're going to work on some of those details of how that works at each school. And we realize that some schools practice at off-site locations in multiple locations. And if we need to work on providing more thermometers at different locations, we will do that. Because this is, in the whole high-level view of this, this is the cheapest, most effective way of preventing and saving a life and is preventing a child from even being put in this situation. If we do have a child or an athlete, or I will even say if a coach experiences, let's just not count out that scenario. The best way to manage exertional heat stroke is very simple. It's called a cold water immersion. And everything that I bring to you in these two protocols are evidence-based. They are researched and evidence-based by healthcare professionals, physicians, and a lot of this research is done by the University of Kentucky and the KSI Corey Stringer Institute, which started after the death of a NFL football player through exertional heat stroke. So this is a research institute. And the mandatory cold water immersion is very simple. Is when an individual is rapidly recognized and assessed as having exertional heat stroke, they are submerged into a tub of cold water of 35 degrees or higher, to cool off the body. Why? Because it's rapid. The whole body needs to be submerged. I have a slide here in a moment. Towels and ice packs are great attempts. Cold showers are great attempts, but it does not rapidly cool off the body. The cells in the body can last about 30 minutes at a temperature of 104 degrees or higher. After that, they start breaking down. And when they break down, you lose central nervous system functions, you lose kidney function, and you lose liver function. Those cells do not regenerate. So if you put, even you get them to the hospital, you can see case after case where over a period of time, they slowly lose function of the kidneys and liver, and then the rest of the body's functions kind of deteriorate from that standpoint. So you have a 30-minute window to take the core temperature from 104 and above to at least 102 before transporting. Rapidly cooling is the best way and the most survivable way of managing an exertional heat stroke. So our motto is cool first, transport second. And we understand that through this protocol, we are going to be working with EMS to educate them and share these protocols as if it would be too accepted so that they would understand our protocol and how we need to manage these cases. Now, I will say, like the AED that's on the wall down there in the hallway, I bet you any money it hasn't been opened, hasn't been used. And that's a great thing. That's a thing to celebrate. Why? But it's there because it's a preventative measure. And this protocol is a preventative measure. I hope that we never have to use it. Although Dr. Browning just used it 2 weeks ago, and literally on the way here, I got a call from an athletic trainer colleague of mine at FIU who had to do this same protocol on a soccer player just 2 days ago and ended up saving his life. And so we are really thrilled being part of this partnership is that we bring evidence-based best practices to the schools. We want to create an environment that is healthy and that is safe so that these athletes can enjoy the sport and they can enjoy it in a safe manner. And so part of our partnership, we wanted to make sure that there was no barriers to success, that there was no limitations to these schools. A lot of schools will say, I would love to be able to be ready to manage the exertional heat stroke, but I don't have the money or the funds. And so we've provided the following items. There's a portable inflatable ice tub that is about 150 gallons that can be taken to remote locations or used as a secondary tub. Can be used across country and different locations. It's portable and it's in a bag and everything's right there ready to go. We provided a 100-gallon industrial Rubbermaid tub. You've seen these at the hardware stores. This is all it takes. We put it in what we call a cool zone at each of the high schools, and they fill it up halfway with water at every practice, and then we provided them with 3 10-gallon igloo coolers, and that's dedicated to fill up with ice so that it's ready in case there's an exertional heat stroke. They place the child into the tub and add the ice. We also have the Datatherm, which is our thermometer, our wet bulb globe thermometer, which we talked about, and a grab-and-go bag that has all the essential equipment from a blood pressure cuff to a pool thermometer to measure the tub temperature, and towels, sheets, and everything to go through this whole protocol without any hiccups, to grab the blue bag and go. We made it simple. So at this point, every high school in Volusia County has every single piece of this equipment. And they've been trained in it. They've been educated in it. And this is something that they're thrilled about. We had a kickoff meeting at the Daytona International Speedway in our suite as part of our partnership. We wanted to meet with the athletic trainers, the athletic directors, and the principals because we believe that this is a team effort. There's not one key player that is from the top down. It is a team effort in making sure that this is a viable method of managing and eliminating and preventing exertional heat stroke. And so we come today with these protocols. These protocols are being used in professional sports. They're being used in collegiate sports. They're being used in high schools. And these were presented to FHSAA, the Florida High School Athletic Association, and they highly recommended it. The reason they did not mandate it is because they have not mandated athletic trainers in every high school across the state. Therefore, one-third of high schools do not have athletic trainers or do not have access, and so they would be asking for medical protocols to be carried out by who? No, they would not have a qualified person. So because of that, they could not mandate it, so they highly recommended it. This is the same document that's been presented to them, just customized to Volusia County. So those are the two protocols, prevention and treatment of exertional heat stroke. And I hope that through your support and through our partnership with Advent Health, we can make positive headlines moving forward when it comes to athlete health and safety. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Eric. And can you share with us, you said that you got a positive reaction from the athletic trainers and the principals. What were some of the thoughts they had, though, that what might interfere with this, or what questions did they have?
That's a good question, and I would say this: athletic trainers, as healthcare providers, are already trained in this. It's in their scope of practice. It's under their state license. They're ready to do this. This is their purpose on your campus is care, prevention, and treatment. A lot of times there is a financial barrier to allow them to do each and everything that they've been trained to do. And that was the biggest thing, is I always wanted this Datatherm, which was X amount of money, or the wet bulb globe, which was X amount of money. But because budgets were tight and limited, they could never fully support all these. So bringing this to them was, it was like Christmas morning, I think I heard 3 or 4 times. They thought this was excellent. The barriers, if I was going to say anything that would restrict us from following through, is the support by coaches and other administration. Not so much the athletic director, but if they find a wet bulb globe temperature environment to be dangerous and they go to a coach and say, you need to modify your practice to 1 hour, we're in category red, are they going to have that support, and is the coach going to follow that? And I think that's what we have, is any protocol or any positive best practice that we bring is everyone on board. And quite honestly, they're going to do these protocols because it's part of their medical training and part of their scope of practice. The purpose behind these protocols as a whole is so we can all be together on it, support it, and engage it, and then keep those accountable through the process to making sure that it's upheld.
I see. And you mentioned the Florida High School Athletic Association, and that you said, I believe you said one-third of them do not, one-third of our high schools do not have athletic trainers. Is that what you mentioned?
Yes, I did.
Is the association taking any stand on the data that you provided us about practicing and when it gets too hot, when it reaches a certain temperature, you have to only practice for X amount of time. Has the association taken any stance on that, that these are the guidelines that high school coaches, athletic trainers should follow?
So when we met with FHSAA up in Gainesville 2 years ago, we presented these protocols to them. And as I was saying, the question is, who's going to uphold them and who's going to deliver these? Obviously, the cold water immersion, anyone can put a child in a cold water tub, but it's that medical decision-making and that recognition that goes above and beyond, just like Dr. Browning and one of our athletic trainers making that medical decision not to transport and to continue to cool. If a school does not have that available to them, it's hard to uphold any medical protocol. And that's the concern that, and so FHSAA was fully supportive of this. And so their press release or their answer to our presentation was, it was highly recommended to engage these protocols within your school districts. And that left it up to the school districts of whether to support these or not. And that's one of the things that we're doing here today. We're bringing it to the school district. Someday, will it become mandate? It may. And I believe me, the first line of defense is having that full-time athletic trainer that is dedicated just to the health and safety of our athletes. So that would change the employment structure in a lot of school districts from a teacher and stipend athletic trainer to a full-time athletic trainer. When we get to that element, that's where these protocols are going to be accepted statewide.
Well, the reason why I'm asking also is that because you refer to a recent tragedy, and I'm just thinking, as if I was a parent of that child who died because of this heat, and proper protocols weren't followed, I'm assuming there, whether they practiced too long or what they did afterwards, and when the student was experiencing these symptoms, wouldn't the school district be liable for that if these are...
Yeah, I mean, well, Hillsborough County is, and I won't speak for all the details, but they are going through a significant amount of change. They just announced that every high school will have a full-time athletic trainer immediately. That was never a ruling. They withdrew all the emergency action plans from all the schools and evaluated them and updated them, and I can't speak on their behalf of what was done. But the child that just recently died was practice. FHSAA sets a guideline of when preseason practices for each sport can start. And when you do it before that, it's considered conditioning. And I think that's the gray area, is the conditioning time frame and what that looks like. And so strength coaches or coaches are doing it who are not medically trained, and they're pushing these kids to kind of adjust to this sure. heat. And I think this child did not have a proper physical completed, and there was no medical staff on site. And therefore there was no protocol to manage. Now they have it. And now they will implement exactly what we're sharing here.
Yeah.
I
wanted to get Mr. Beal to weigh in, and I know that you want to. Just given the competitive nature of coaches and all of the emphasis on winning, and we all deal with it, it's just part of our culture, I just wanted you, Larry, if you could just speak to it a little bit. You've been in this business a long, long time.
Part of what the FHSA requires is every coach, there's a policy 41 that is in the Red Book that we refer to in the athletic world that is published by FHSA every year, is updated by multiple committees. So policy 41, every coach has to be aware and understanding not only the heat illness, but cardiac arrest and concussions as well. So every year, all coaches under FHSA rule is every paid coach, every head coach is supposed to watch these three videos on the National Federation of High Schools. They're free. They're about 40 minutes apiece. In Volusia County, when we started going this direction with the FHSA, I require it of every coach. And we monitor it in my office. We build a database. The athletic directors, we call them. We speak with them. You know, coaches are missing this and this and this. Make sure they get it done. Let's watch the video. It's free. There's no cost. The only part is time. But when you watch the videos, you will hear coaches say, hey, I didn't see that last year. I didn't catch that. Or this was a pretty good refresher. So when something does happen, they might not have a written script in front of them, but they start acting off of what is in their brain, what is it telling them to do, and they start reacting to the situation. So policy 41 is supposed to be followed by everybody in the state of Florida who is a Florida High School Athletic Association school. The videos, it kind of opens your eyes a little bit. You know, some people say, it's a little boring. We saw it last year. When they watched it again this year, they're like, oh, they changed some things. So they are updating them. They are revamping them. And they are working for, you know, making something as a better product. But it's going to help us all in the long run. What FHSA has always done or has done in the past, as we put out the concussion policy, all coaches are removed from that policy. It is the healthcare professional, the athletic trainer. It is the athletic director or the principal who makes the call whether or not that child is released and goes back into activity. The coaches can be part of the four-step process, but a coach cannot overrule by FHSA laws that, well, that kid can go back in, give them their helmet and put them back in. They cannot do that. So they have totally been removed from the situation, which is a good thing. I tell the coaches, it removes you from liability. Oh, okay, I'm good with that, Mr. Buell. We can move forward. Because now they don't become part of the situation. It becomes the healthcare professionals and the administration of the school. We're also, what I'm doing is putting together an interoffice memorandum that'll go to the athletic trainer, it'll go to the athletic director and the principals, kind of outlining what do we do for reading the wet bulb globe thermometer. What are our step-by-steps? Where do we really start focusing? What zone, red and black? Orange, we should also make some adjustments. But making sure that we know if the reading is done by the athletic trainer or the athletic director, and when it's done, when we hit these levels, who do we notify, and how is the information presented to the coaches? As well as cold water immersion, and what we're doing, what are our steps, and who is taking the lead on this, which cold water immersion is the athletic trainer and everybody supporting them. Wet bulb globe is the athletic director and athletic trainer and moving forward in that those processes.
Well, I'm sure that other board members may have some questions too, I'm sure, but I was just thinking when you were going through that thermometer and the temperatures and how long you can practice, and it was the black was
92.1 Fahrenheit.
92, I'm thinking every afternoon it's 92.
So that's not ambient air temperature.
Okay.
So ambient air temperature, it might be 95 outside, but the wet bulb may only be 85.
Oh.
So it takes into consideration humidity. It takes into consideration wind speed. You know what it's like if you're in the shade or you're out in the sun, whether there's a breeze or no breeze. You can feel the temperature. Even though the temperature is the same outside, you can feel it different on your body. It's also different whether you're on grass, turf, dirt, like a softball field, a tennis court. It varies. The band out on the asphalt can be 2 or 3 degrees higher.
But then it's also true, as you said, sometimes the heat index is higher, obviously, than the ambient air temperature. So I don't know how that fits into...
Well, it doesn't really fit into this. This is wet bulb globe. So if someone tries to use this chart and use a heat index, it won't work because you'll never practice.
That's what I was alluding to, that there will be no practice ever.
For instance, this Saturday, I took some temperatures just randomly just to see. And on the grass outside at noon was about 85.6, but it was about 92 degrees outside. So it took in the speed, it took in the time of the day, the direction, wind, and stuff like that. Out on the asphalt was about 3 degrees higher from, it was about 87. So if you plugged in 87 here, you'd be in that gold. Still be able to practice for 2 hours. You just have to make some modifications. And that the policy 41 that Larry's talking about, which is so key, is to acclimate a child to participation. Is what that's geared up for is the first 14 days. It gives stringent guidelines just like this of when conditioning can occur, when they can add pads and helmets and stuff like that, because they need to acclimate individuals. Unfortunately, if we don't have that acclimatization period, they can the heat's a lot to take in.
And is that chart just for football?
No, this is for all sports.
Doesn't it just seem to make sense that if I'm running cross country, let's say, wearing basically nothing, and compared to what a football player has on, obviously I'm going to get a lot hotter, it would seem like, in full football pads and gear than the cross-country runner.
Yeah, so you're talking also, you're talking maybe two things, is how frequent would a football player experience exertional heat illness versus a cross-country runner? Well, the football player is going to more because, you know, head dissipate your heat dissipates from your head, but if you have a helmet on, you're trapping it in. You're trapping in your core temperature with your pads, and so you're not going to experience it. If you look at the chart of the risk factors, you're going to see that individuals in cross-country are not our first concern, okay? It's our, you know, those that have protective equipment, whether it's lacrosse or football. It's also the time of the year and the temperature. So if you look at like the gold section here or the orange there, it says for footballs, they will be restricted to helmet and shoulder pads and shorts only. And then it goes on, but then for all sports, it talks about the rest breaks and the water breaks. So it will break it down to how it's modified for each sport.
Thank you. I didn't want to cut off.
No, that's
Mr.
Okay.
Bieler.
Speaking to part of a little background for the question that you asked as well, I believe, and Eric can correct me, about 10 days ago, a female basketball player in Atlanta running preseason conditioning stadium, middle of the afternoon, young lady fell out. So it doesn't discriminate by sport. It is depending on the conditions, what you're doing, where you're doing it, and all those different variables. So there is a number of things involved with that. What we've also done is there is a heat index app that can be used on an Apple phone or a Android. We have sent that to all principals, ADs, athletic directors, and Dr. Kellermeyer has sent it out to all PE teachers as well. So they have access to this. So we are making adjustments based on what Eric and Anna have presented. We're making adjustments across the board, kindergarten through 12th grade. So these coaches have this on their phones. I've sent it to Greg Aiken, so they could use it out in the field, because sometimes our workers are out there, they're not monitoring this, they're trying to get the job done.
Exactly.
But when you get into, we don't have the ability to give everybody a wet bulb globe thermometer, but they can monitor the news, they can monitor the heat index app, and if they see that they're getting into that far right range, okay, we need to take a break, we need to get some water, we need to get into the air conditioner somewhere cool, and then we move on from there. So we have done that across the board with the Heat Index app. They're two totally different things, should not be confused, like Eric was explaining. There's a lot more variables that go into this, but if you look at it from a layman standpoint, you're like, oh, we can't be out in practice after 86 degrees. Mm-hmm. It's 86 degrees based on multiple variables. It's not just based on the temperature.
Yeah.
So there's other things that come into play, and that's why... a certain person or persons.
Thank you. Ms. Cuthbert had a question.
I think you need to contact cheerleading sponsors as well as band directors.
Right.
And not just athletic coaches. And you said that we don't have, all of our schools do not have an athletic trainer, correct?
Right now, currently, all 10 do.
They do.
One of our athletic directors is also working as an athletic trainer. Atlantic High School was the last one that needed an athletic trainer. We were working at our last cabinet meeting, we were discussing working an assistant principal who is a certified athletic trainer was covering both. We have since hired someone on. She started last Thursday.
Then who's in charge of the Whitbulb globe thermometer? Would it be the athletic director or the trainer?
Currently, what I'm putting out is it would be both, because our athletic trainers are teaching classes, and they could be in a classroom first period through seventh, where our athletic directors have the ability to be more mobile. So if they see a perceived temperature range, they need to start looking at that 30 minutes to an hour prior to the end of school, so they can start making adjustments then, instead of making adjustments at 3:40 when kids are coming out to the fields to practice. The same thing goes with ROTC and band as well.
Yeah. Because you're going to have maybe three sports practicing all at the same time. You're going to, and band as well. So you can have soccer. Soccer is running up and down. I mean, you can get heaps illness extremely quickly. As well as in the weight room. Sometimes the weight room doesn't have air conditioning. Mm-hmm. And all that exertion, that also creates it. So we need to expand. So, and as our coaches come and go, hopefully our athletic director will make sure that they're aware of the app as well as the and have training. Are you going to have ongoing training?
Absolutely. That's what we're here for. So any training of coaches, athletic directors, athletic trainers, absolutely.
Okay. And it's just sometimes equipment gets mislaid or not, it gets stuck in a drawer or in a cabinet or a closet. And I just want to make sure that we have one point person on each campus who's in charge of all of this to make sure whoever is out on the field is in charge of that and then has to be returned. Because if we have the band director, because seventh period, a lot of kids have football or basketball or band, and that's when they go out to practice in the field. Mm-hmm. So you can have one section over here football, one section soccer, one section the band, and who's in charge of the thermometer to make sure that it's everybody is aware of what's happening, especially at the beginning of school.
We also discussed there may be a need for multiple units at each school, depending on, you know, participation. If band and football and soccer are all going, everyone that is outside, even the coaches, are at risk of this. So this is not to isolate anything just to football. It's just they're the highest risk factor, and we start with that from a discussion standpoint. But you're absolutely right. And if we need to put additional units and assign them to the band director or to the athletic director, and accordingly, I know Larry will work with us on that.
And Mrs. Cuthbert, that was definitely part of our conversation as we delved into this, is football is our place to start. But we see that this is a much bigger conversation that all of our students who are outside in the afternoons in a whole variety of practices would be impacted by the heat. And we need to have that communication, not only, you know, go to our sports team and our football folks, but that's a campus-wide, you know, alert that it's not safe to be outside. And we did have that discussion, too, about indoors. You're right. Things like wrestling and basketball can get awfully hot if there's no air conditioning in those gyms or in those practice areas. So those students are vulnerable as well. And in addition, in the videos that the coaches have to watch about heat acclimatization, you know, they talk about, you know, student athletes who are at different risk factors as well. You know, if they have some other condition that would make them be more susceptible to the heat. So, again, football is,
you know, what everyone thinks about, but we have students who have a host of other issues that might also make them more susceptible to falling ill with heat illness. Okay,
thank you. Thank you, Ms. Cuthbert. Ms. Haynes.
So, first of all, I want to say thank you. I want to, for all of the supplies that you have donated and the time that you have put into training our staff and your willingness to continue to train them. My question is, what does this device cost?
The wet bulb globe?
Yes.
That thermometer cost, I believe it was about $130.
Okay. So how many are you willing to put on our campuses? Because I actually don't believe that one is enough. Mm-hmm. Because having had children that played sports and were involved in band, I will tell you, you know, we've got a lot of events coming up where we're going to put our bands out walking on the pavement in parades. And personally, my son played the quads. Mm. And I remember one time at the Deltona parade, because that's in the middle of the day, the hottest time coming up, as I always would meet him at the end with cold water. But as I met him, he was just like, please lift this off of me. And he's a big guy, you know, so it wasn't like, you know, he was a tiny person carrying this, but, you know, it was lifted off, get the jacket off me, and put me in a car. And I actually felt at that time that he was probably mm-hmm. having a heat exertion piece. Mm-hmm. So I thank you. I mean, what you've done and what you're doing collaboratively with us to ensure that our students' safety in this aspect, you know, without you, we couldn't be where we're at. But I don't think one device is enough, because we've got kids practicing everywhere. And I don't want there to be one device and it's, you know, one person holding on to it and then we're not. Because even this summer, you know, prior to pre-planning week, you know, DeLand High had practices going on. They had band there every day.
Right.
They had football there every day. They had the cheerleaders there. And one of the gymnasiums there has no air in it. And so, you know, and if you can't partner with us to provide more, then I think it's a priority that we need to look at, because I don't ever want to be in the situation that we're making a phone call to a parent.
Absolutely.
And we've lost a student.
They're absolutely.
We should, you know.
Nope. It's preventable.
It's preventable.
Yes.
Yeah, I think we can absolutely provide these. We paid for all of this equipment as part of our in-kind contribution through our partnership. So I think it's just looking at the budget and figuring out on a school-by-school basis what the needs are. You know, some schools practice all in one location, so maybe there's only a need for two or three versus other schools that may be all over the county practicing where there's a larger need. So we can work with Larry and Kelly on that and come up with a total number that needs to be purchased.
Yeah, it would seem like you'd need a minimum of three, Mr. Colon.
So first of all, I want to thank you, Mr. Egner. Actually, we were in Tampa when that child died at a Florida School Board Association meeting, and I remember sitting in the hotel and listening to, you know, it was the hometown news.
Yeah.
And poor Mr. Egner, right when he finally had email, I think that was one of the first emails that I fired off and asked, you know, this can't happen in Volusia County. And, you know, as I've learned more about this, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And one of the things that concerns me is, you know, and I appreciate AdventHealth's partnership and bringing this information to us, but now that we have this information, now we have a different scenario, because our middle schools, and again, it may be, you know, the coach goes out, determines it's safe today, documents that it's safe, and we're good to go. So I think, you know, as a district, for me personally, I can speak for Ruben, this is a non-negotiable. This is something that must be done and followed. And I had a conversation with Mr. Egner yesterday, and I'm glad you brought it up, Larry. You know, in healthcare, we say if it's not documented, it didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And so ensuring that, you know, there are two folks who determine, okay, so we have two folks who are going to sign off and verify that we did this wet bulb. Now, I will tell you, and working in places where there are checklists, you know, you'll see the refrigerator log and it's missing 2 or 3 days. It's the last day of the month. And, you know, miraculously at the end, it's all filled in. But, you know, having two folks say, I am responsible for ensuring the safety of students, I don't know many people who are just going to go, okay, I'll sign off on that even though we didn't do the wet bulb. And so ensuring that it's actually being documented, you know, that the athletic directors are keeping these logs, because now that it's been presented to us and now that we have a protocol, this is legally binding. Did you, it's kind of like the speed trap, you know. The first thing the attorneys say to them, did you measure your speed gun? Did you calibrate it? If you didn't, then guess what? You can't, this ticket doesn't stand. And so as a school district, you know, I'm very concerned because now we have this information, and I think we need to ensure that we are documenting that this is actually taking place every single time, non-negotiably, in order, because this is the prevention side. You know, if we do this side right, all of the extreme thought process that goes into dropping a temperature is not as high of a consideration. It's there as a safety blanket, you know. And so, you know, whether it's through the partnership, which is within the scope, whether it's us purchasing it, I saw your picture on Facebook. I actually thought, man, that'd be cool to have one of these. And I went on Amazon. It was $100 and some odd, and I decided, no, I don't need any. I don't need one of these. But, you know, ensuring, Larry, that our policies and processes are in place where there are the checks and balances in the same fashion, you know, because we're talking about prevention consequences. You know, what happens when the wet bulb is locked up in a cabinet and the band director can't get to it and says, you know what, I'm just going to go outside no matter what? Well, that's a problem. You know, or, you know, again, we have sports in our middle schools. You know, what are we going to do about them? You know, again, that may not be within the scope of the partnership, but it's important to have a coach who can go outside in the middle of the day, whether it's PE, and make a calculated assessment versus, I felt it was okay. Mm-hmm. And so, again, for me personally, I mean, and I've had the conversations with Mr. Egner, and I believe he's on the same page. This is a non-negotiable. And if, you know, we were at the event at the Speedway that we had for the football players, and a professional football player was talking to parents, and he said, you know, it's a different day from when we were, when I played professional football. You know, when I played professional football, you went out there and you were out there the whole time and got beat up and they gave you some water, you beat your head and you ran out there and go do it again. You know, those days are over. Even in professional sports, those days are over. Now they measure the amount of contacts. Now they measure, you know, all of that. And so with that being said, like I said, I've had plenty of conversation with Mr. Egner, and I think that, you know, it's important that not only is it a non-negotiable, but that it is documented. Because if it's not documented, it didn't happen, and not documenting it will put us at risk.
And to your point, Mr. Colon, we obviously will be taking this to principals, because school-based administrators need to oversee this process. We realize that, you know, the athletic trainer by themselves should not be the only person in charge of this entire process, that it needs to be, you know, overseen by a specific administrator on each campus.
Right, and the coaches understand that when they say stop, it's stop. When it says 20-minute breaks, you need to document when you took that break, because if a kid passes out shortly thereafter and you have a protocol that says these breaks needed to happen, there has to be a timekeeper. You know, you can't, who's going to be able to measure 20 minutes in their head, you know, when 20 minutes have elapsed? Nobody is. And so putting these processes in place, which will ensure that we're following it, you know, as it should be, because otherwise, I mean, now that it's in writing, you know, we are held to this. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Colon. Ms. Haynes?
To add on to what Mr. Colon said, I spent part of my career teaching at the elementary level, and I will tell you that lots of times in schedules, we would take kindergartners out at the hottest point of the day. you know, and those are little people that, you know, some of them are 30 pounds. I mean, that's how tiny they are, and we would take them out at the hottest point of the day. And trust me, I love, you know, PE coaches at the elementary level, but I ran across some in my time that, you know, they coached baseball at the high school, and this is what they'd say to me when I took those little people out there. They'd say, it's okay, my baseball players, you know, this afternoon will be out here in the heat, you know, for 3 hours practicing. And I'm like, but these are five-year-olds. And yeah. I would say, you know, could we not have them running for 30 minutes or the 45 minutes? Because I, as a teacher, then took them back in where the sweat's dripping off of them and their cheeks are bloody red. And so I'd like to also ask that, you know, you said middle school. I think we need to really talk to our, you know, PE people or the groups that are taking them outside of the elementary school too, because a 30-pound little five-year-old becomes dehydrated a whole lot more quicker than a 150 to 200-pound, you know, middle and high schooler that, you know, can actually run that and is conditioned to run it. And little people don't stop. Like, they never stop and think, I'm tired, I'm worn out. It's the same thing why you always take them to the restroom before you take them outside, because they don't stop to think about those things because they're five and six. And so I think, you know, this, I learned a lot. Like, I enjoyed reading your presentation prior to today, and I looked up some things from it, so I learned a lot that I didn't know. And I think we need to educate at all levels whenever we're going to have kids outside for any length of period of time. We need to stop and think about it, because the kids don't stop and think about it, and they don't stop when they don't think I'm overheated and something's going to happen.
Right. Okay, Mr. Egner, did you want to come back?
Comments and one statement of implication. We were doing this right from the get-go, which means focus on prevention. Research was done. Training was done. The equipment was provided. I sent out a message to all principals with an expectation it be implemented, and that was all principals. And now we're talking about how we're going to monitor it in special situations, and I'm sure I saw Mr. Beal taking notes, and I'm sure he will get back to the board with that. But where we didn't have the bulb, I asked Mr. Beal to make sure he sent out the app, so that could be used in all situations, circumstances, though not as effective, it still gave you a strong indicator. So that's already been done. So now it's this follow-up of this. However, one of the things I always like to do when we kind of all get on the bandwagon and talk about some of these things, understanding that this is not an FHSAA policy, and understanding the implications. So I say that only because the board is very supportive right now. Will they be equally supportive when the band director at the whatever march, you put the name on it, says, whoops, my band's not marching. And so now we're not represented, and suddenly there's a big brouhaha and someone wants the band director fired. Would we be as supportive at a state conference match in which the FHSAA does not stop the match because of this, but one of our coaches says, well, my team can't participate, and now we've forfeited. So remember the level of support you offer today in the real-world situations our principals, coaches, teachers, band directors face, and would that level of support be equally strong?
Thank you for that, and we're going to wrap this up here. Ms. Cuthbert, I think you haven't had a chance.
Clearly, our elementary schools do not have gyms. They're, all the physical activity is outside under a pavilion. There are a couple of elementary schools without a cover, so that is to be considered. And also, our middle schools, their two intramural activities are cross-country, and they're outside, and there's a lot of intramural things, as well as basketball. But that's a good point you brought up, Mr. Egner. Thank you. I think all of us, the safety and the security of our students always have to come first. Competitions come and go. There's always next year. But we have to support, especially when your protocols and all the paperwork that you provided us are very clear, research-based, and it's, if it's based in medical, medical protocol, mm-hmm. and for what you've recommended to us as a very legitimate business partner, I think we need to follow what we set up. So thank you very much. And by reading a lot of what you've written, I was amazed how clear and how very sensible it is. So it's to me, it's a no-brainer. So
thank you, Ms. Cuthbert. Mr. Colon, you want to follow
and,
up?
And to answer you, for me, the answer is yes, because the incident that he related to was not in our county. It was in another county where, you know what, if our coaches had done what was right that day when it was a little bit warm, I'll leave that there, okay, we would have said, you know what, no. Or we would have said, had it been in the red zone, okay, we have an hour. And so this is how long our kids are going to play because this is what is safe. And one of the things that I've learned in many ethical situations is when somebody calls out safety, security with a measured approach, not a perceived approach, here it is. And so, coach, if you want to take your team out with a wet bulb of 95.7, have at it. We're not taking our kids out there. And I will support any in my three high schools, three middle schools, and ten elementary. Because half my kids are, a third of my kids are at university. I would support this all day long because it is measured. It is not perceived. You can't make up the number. So that's my thought. Thank you.
Thank you. And we thank you. And we really do. You've certainly touched a nerve here and made us all think about what truly matters, and certainly, as Ms. Cuthbert said, and Mr. Colon, Ms. Haynes, there isn't anything more important than the health and safety of our students. And when you're, so provided knowledge about what's in the best interest mm-hmm. of them for their health, then it's hard to say, well, I know that's right, but I'm going to do something different. And you know, we just don't act like that. So. We thank you for that. I'm going to suggest, based on what I've heard from the board, that we give Mr. Egner an opportunity to perhaps meet with our business partners and with Mr. Beal and with Kelly, and you all talk about it and perhaps can bring something back to the board that can provide the level of comfort that thing, that all of us want and want all of our PE coaches, band directors, anyone that deals with outside sports, principals, assistant principals, that they have this knowledge and that we somehow can provide them with the equipment that they need so that every level has the same protection.
Consistent implementation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you. And thank you all.
Thank you for having us.
We greatly appreciate the partnership with
Ben
Health.
We appreciate it, too.
You all have been great.
Thank you.
Board members, unless you all have a question about anything else, I think we should adjourn the workshop.